You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, takes on the world news.
This is Jeff Blankford, welcoming you to the June 13th edition of Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. Before getting on with today's program, I wish to thank once again those of you who pledged your support to Takes on the World and for Joy LeClaire's forthright radio on May 23rd that enabled us to exceed our goal for that hour and inspire us to keep bringing you the kind of programming that you're not likely to hear on any other radio station. Those of you who missed the opportunity to make your pledge that day can still do so by going to kzyx.org and pressing on that red donate button. It's actually a rectangle at the top of the page. Thank you, and now on to today's program. Now, when it comes to the actions and antics of Donald Trump, we can't say he didn't warn us that if elected, he was going to reshape America's relationship with our closest allies, who he accused of abusing us in every way that one country can abuse another short of launching a shooting war. And so he has, first by pulling the U.S. out of the Trans-Pacific Trade Partnership, which many Democrats and labor unions applauded, followed by withdrawing the U.S. from the Paris Climate Agreement, which outside of his xenophobic fan base was greeted with universal disapproval. As promised, he began renegotiating NAFTA, demanding terms from Canada and Mexico more beneficial, in his opinion, to the U.S., then initiating over the last month a trade war with Washington's long-standing allies that could be devastating to America as well as the world's economy. Finally, on Monday, he made an early exit from the G7 meeting in Ottawa after scrapping with fellow Western leaders over trade issues, leaving a trail of insulting tweets as he hopped over to Singapore to have his historic one-on-one with North Korea's Kim Jong-un, the outcome of which is too early to do more than speculate. In sum, after a year and a half in office, President Trump has succeeded in what critics from liberals to neocons complain is upending the post-1945 U.S.-dominated world order, alienating the U.S. from its closest allies in a way that can only bring smiles to the face of Russian President Vladimir Putin. In the Middle East, Putin has a lot to thank Trump for, was the headline of Robert Fisk's May 29th column in the Independent of London. In that lengthy article, Fisk, the dean of Middle East correspondence, describes how Trump's decisions have opened the door for what can be seen as a successful charm offensive by the Russian leader, who manages to maintain good relations with the heads of state of every country in the region, even those who are sworn enemies of one another. At 15 minutes past the hour, I'll be speaking with Robert Fisk for 20 minutes about his article, Web, that is Middle Eastern Politics Today, after which I'll conclude my commentary, so stay tuned for that. Until then, I'm going to focus on a subject which has long been more subject to distortion by the U.S. media than any other, namely the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. It has been predictably delinquent in its reporting of Israel's response to the weekly March of Return protests by thousands of Gazans over the last 2 months that have seen more than 150 Palestinians killed by Israeli sniper fire, with thousands more wounded. Having no correspondence actually at the scene of the shooting, most of the U.S. media, like our political class, has relied on the press statements of Israel's propaganda ministry, which places blame for all the deaths and injuries on Hamas. Consequently, you will not find any mention of reports such as that on June 6 in the prestigious British medical journal BMJ by Nafees Abu Shaban, head of plastic and reconstructive surgery at Gaza's Shifa Hospital, in which he describes in detail the effect of the special bullets that the Israeli snipers lying safely behind dirt berms have used on unarmed protesters. Quote, "The humanitarian agency Médecins Sans Frontières, that's Doctors Without Borders, has been operating in Gaza," he writes, "and says that the people have been shot with bullets that have caused fist-sized wounds of unusual severity." Marie Elizabeth Angra, head of MSF Palestine, says in their report that, quote, "half of the more than 500 patients we have admitted in our clinics have injuries where the bullet has literally destroyed tissue after having pulverized bone." And these patients, she wrote on Médecins Sans Frontières website in April, 2 months ago, before the numbers of the wounded greatly expanded, quote, "will need to have very complex surgical operations, and most of them will have disabilities for life." That is what we are facing, writes Dr. Abu Shaban. I have seen a great deal of physical trauma in Gaza following Israeli attacks, but have not seen these kind of injuries before. From the appearance of the wounds, concludes Dr. Abu Shaban, there appears to have been systematic use by Israeli Defense Force snipers of ammunition with an expanding butterfly effect. End quote. The international response condemning Israel came in a resolution introduced by Kuwait at a special meeting of the UN Security Council on June 1st, which, as expected, USU Ambassador Nikki Haley vetoed. Haley, in turn, offered her own resolution, placing all the blame on Hamas, making not a single mention of the Palestinian casualties. When it failed to garner a single vote other than her own, Haley lashed out at the Security Council, saying, quote, "It is now completely clear the UN is hopelessly biased against Israel. The United States will not allow such bias, which is why we did not hesitate to cast our veto." A lone voice speaking up for the Palestinians has been Senator Bernie Sanders, but unlike when he was running for president and in the immediate aftermath of elections when he was frequently interviewed, you won't hear much of what he has to say on mainstream media. Back in April, after the first violent Israeli response to the Gazans' march of return, Sanders told CNN that he didn't accept Israel's justification for shooting live ammunition at protesters. Earlier, he had tweeted, quote, that the killing of Palestinian demonstrators by Israeli forces in Gaza is tragic. It is the right of all people to protest for a better future without a violent response. Meanwhile, he added, the situation in Gaza remains a humanitarian disaster. The U.S. must play a more positive role in ending the Gaza blockade and helping Palestinians and Israelis build a future that works for all. But Sanders didn't stop there. Writing in the Jewish Weekly Forward on Monday, Peter Beinart pointed out that while, quote, not many in the media are noticing, but in the shadow of Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu, Bernie Sanders is dramatically challenging Beltway discourse on Israel. Last month, he wrote, Sanders crossed one of the red lines demarcating politically acceptable Washington discourse about Israel. He organized the first letter written by multiple senators criticizing Israel's blockade of the Gaza Strip. Then last week, he raced past that line again with a video that is unlike anything I've ever seen from an American senator. For starters, writes Beinart, it consists entirely of interviews with Palestinians in Gaza. That alone is extraordinary. Palestinians in Gaza are almost never included in the debates on American TV. Palestinians are rarely invited to hold public briefings on Capitol Hill, and when they are, it's hugely controversial. In his video, Beinart goes on, Sanders lets Palestinians from Gaza speak for themselves, and they say things American politicians simply don't say. Again and again, the speakers, who are not politicians but rather academics, students, and journalists, call Gaza a prison. End quote. That's an excerpt from Peter Beinart's article in the June 11th Forward, New York Jewish Weekly, which contains links to Sanders' latest video. In case you may be wondering what has been happening on this issue in our congressional district, there has been a petition circulating on the Roots Action website criticizing the positions of our Representative Jared Huffman. The first issue on the petition deals with Representative Huffman's unwillingness to sign his name to House Resolution 4391, promoting human rights by ending Israeli military detention of Palestinian Children Act. It was introduced by Betty McCollum of Minnesota and is designed to make sure that the military aid the U.S. sends to Israel every year is not used to harm children. The petition goes on, after all the in-person requests, the multiple talks with staff, the hundreds of letters and phone calls, we see no sign he will support it. Congressman Huffman, the petition continued, seems to have given his full support for the shooting of unarmed protesters in Gaza, blaming Palestinians themselves for the actions of Israeli military snipers. When pressed at a public forum on May 11th about his silence on the subject, the petition asserts, Huffman replied by saying, quote, let's talk about Hamas pushing kids into dangerous situations, end quote. A third charge on the petition was that, quote, on May 8th, Huffman signed on to another bill, H.R. 5141, that promises more than $3.8 billion in U.S. aid to the Israeli military with no accountability whatsoever, end quote. On the receipt of the petition, I wrote to Representative Huffman to get his responses. There is not sufficient time to read his entire email, but here are his replies to the particular issues raised, and I probably will continue them after I speak with Robert Fisk. Huffman writes to me, quote, "I am concerned about the treatment of children in Israel, Palestine Authority, Gaza, and everywhere else for that matter. I agree that the U.S. should include this issue as a priority in our relationship with Israel, and I'm looking into an appropriate letter or resolution to voice that concern short of threatening to cut off all foreign aid, the McCollum resolution, which I believe is not a realistic or appropriate response. The core of our disagreement," continued Huffman, "is that I support the State of Israel's right to exist and defend itself against very real and growing security threats that would be hard for most Americans to imagine living with. Those threats," writes Huffman, "are never seriously acknowledged by the anti-Israel groups, who also refuse to acknowledge and consider the abuses and atrocities that occur on the Palestinian side of the conflict. In their very biased framing, there is only one evil villain, Israel, a totally innocent victim, Palestinians, and no nuances or countervailing perspectives. They portray Hamas as a benevolent organizer of a nonviolent protest at the Gaza border. In reality, Hamas is a cynical and ruthless terrorist group that is deliberately lying to and exploiting civilians and children in ways that it knows will get them hurt or killed in hopes of generating useful media coverage," writes Huffman. "And as much as I deplore terrible humanitarian conditions in Gaza, if you stubbornly lay 100% of the responsibility for that on Israel and refuse to discuss Hamas or Egypt, then your conversation is not really about humanitarianism, it's about attacking Israel," end quote. Well, those are the words of our congressional representative, Jared Huffman. And needless to say, I don't agree with his assessment, which seems to be based on the talking points provided by Israel's overactive U.S. lobby. I also must add, whereas he contends that those criticizing Israel's behavior are doing so because they're anti-Israel, the initiator of the petition and very many of the activists who have been foremost among those protesting the Gaza massacre happen to be Jewish, and they are joined in doing so by a small minority of Israeli Jews who object to what Israel is doing in their name. I have extended an invitation, Representative Huffman, to come on Takes on the World and discuss this, other aspects of U.S. foreign policy, and I hope at some point he will respond. There's one particular Israeli, Haaretz columnist Gideon Levy, who I have interviewed on this program, who has not hesitated to unconditionally condemn his country's actions. The latest atrocity which attracted his and the world's attention was the murder of a 21-year-old young woman, Palestinian medic Razan al-Najjar, clearly identified as such by an Israeli sniper. He writes, a few short words, "Razan al-Najjar isn't an angel of mercy," sum up the depths of Israeli propaganda, writes Levy. Avichai Edrei, the Israeli army's Arabic language spokesman, who also speaks in my name, writes Levy, is a representative of an army of mercy that also now has appointed itself the judge of the measure of mercy in a medic treating Palestinian wounded on Gaza's border with Israel, and who Israeli army soldiers mercilessly killed. After killing her, Levy points out, referring to an army-made video that attempted to link her to Hamas and which was headlined in the New York Times, he says, it was also necessary to assassinate her character. Propaganda is a tool that serves many countries. In Israel, it's called Hasbara, public diplomacy, because why would it need propaganda? Recently, its propaganda has sunk to such despicable lows, writes Levy, that nothing can better prove that its justifications have run out, its excuses gone, the truth is the enemy, and all that's left are lies and slander. A medic in a nursing uniform has been shot to death by Israeli army snipers, as have journalists with press vests and an amputee in a wheelchair. If we rely on Israeli army snipers to know what they are doing, counting on them to be the most accurate in the world, then these people have been shot deliberately, writes Levy. Surely, if the army had believed in the justice of the military campaign that it is waging in Gaza, it would have taken responsibility for these killings, apologizing, expressing regret, and offering compensation. But when the earth is burning under our feet, when we know the truth and understanding that shooting at demonstrators and killing more than 120 of them and rendering hundreds of others disabled is more akin to a massacre, one cannot apologize or express regret. Israel's ambassador in London, Mark Regev, who is another top polished propagandist, writes Libby, was quick to tweet about the, quote, the medical volunteer, in quotation marks, as if a Palestinian could not be a medical volunteer. Instead, Regev wrote, her death is, quote, yet another reminder of Hamas's brutality, end quote. The army kills a medic in a white uniform in an outrageous violation of international law, which provides protection for medical personnel in combat zones, and that's despite the fact that Gaza border does not constitute a combat zone, but it's Hamas that is a brutal one. Kill me, Mr. Ambassador, but who could possibly follow this twisted, sick logic? Asked Gideon Levy in Haaretz. I should mention that the May 18th Jewish Weekly Forward carried a story ignored by the mainstream media about an Israeli government-linked crowdsourced propaganda app that was used to successfully manipulate reactions to the Facebook posts on major news outlets following Israel's killing of 60 Palestinians in Gaza. Facebook acknowledged that the app directing its users to, quote, like it, became the top comments on more than a dozen posts from major news outlets about the May 14th shooting, including posts by The Wall Street Journal and CNN. The app, called ECT.IL, IL stands for Israel, is a joint project of Sheldon Adelson's Israeli-American Council and IDC Herzliya, an Israeli university. As The Forward reported last November, it works closely with Israel's intelligence community and its Ministry of Strategic Affairs. Wouldn't you think it should have to register as a foreign agent? Well, when it comes to Israel and its organizations in this country, they get a waiver. We've had a number of people have to register as foreign agents, but all the organizations lobbying for Israel do not have to do that. President John F. Kennedy in 1962 became outraged at some of Israel's behavior, particularly their efforts to hide their atomic weapons program. And he called on the American Zionist Council, which is the predecessor to AIPAC, to register as a foreign agent. And the Justice Department or his brother Robert proceeded to do that, but the lawyers for the American Zionist Council obfuscated, delayed until November 22, 1963, when John F. Kennedy was assassinated and Lyndon Johnson, who at that time became the most pro-Israel president in history, allowed the case to diminish and die, and no U.S. president or no U.S. Justice Department has made an effort to do that since, to force the AIPAC, in this case, to register as a foreign agent, which it clearly is, representing Israel in the United States and has a tremendous influence over our members of Congress. Kennedy, by the way, also supported the Palestinian right of return, even though he didn't demand that all the Palestinians be allowed to return. He did call for the support of the principle and that at least 100,000 be allowed to return. And at one point, Adlai Stevenson met with Ben-Gurion, the Prime Minister of Israel, and told him that after all, the refugees were Israel's fault and they had to deal with that issue. We don't hear about that at all. And no other U.S. president has ever called or supported the idea of Palestinian right of return. And thirdly, of course, President Kennedy opposed Israel's attempts to get nuclear. And to keep them from doing that, he gave them defensive weapons, which were later used to make people believe that President Kennedy was a big supporter of Israel. In fact, if you read Cy Hirsch's Samson Option, after Kennedy became president, and evidently the lobby had helped him win in Illinois, Abe Feinberg, a major behind-the-scenes player for the Democratic Party and for Israel in the United States, came to Kennedy's office and told him, well, we helped get you elected president. Now we want to let you know, we want to tell you what your Middle East policy should be. And Kendi, after Feinberg left the office, came out and was raging, furious to his staff members. Feinberg was also the one who, when President Harry Truman was running for office and was short of money for his railroad trip around the country, Feinberg was the one who came and put a large envelope that contained maybe $2 million in his pocket. And even Kennedy used to tell that story. A little history, which you're not going to find anywhere else. Before I conclude this segment, you recall you've heard a lot in the past week and been reading and hearing eulogies to the famed chef and TV host Anthony Bourdain, whose program Parts Unknown took him to kitchens all over the world, who reportedly committed suicide in the Paris hotel room. What you haven't read or heard is about his visit to Gaza for Parts Unknown. You may have seen that, Bob, in which he met with people and learned about the food they loved as well as the problems caused by Israel's suffocating occupation. For this, he was recognized with an award from the Muslim Public Affairs Council, where he made the following brief acceptance speech, which I'm going to play for you now.
I'm very, very honored for this award, the Impact Voices of Courage and Conscience Media Award. There was, however, very little courage, and one would hope an ordinary amount of conscience at work in producing our Israel-Palestine episode of Parts Unknown. I was enormously grateful for the response from Palestinians in particular, for doing what seemed to me an ordinary thing, something we do all the time, show regular people doing everyday things, cooking and enjoying meals, playing with their children, talking about their lives, their hopes, and dreams. It is a measure, I guess, of how twisted and shallow our depiction of a people is that these images come as a shock to so many. The world has visited many terrible things on the Palestinian people, none more shameful than robbing them of their basic humanity. People are not statistics. That is all we attempted to show. A small, pathetically small step towards understanding. To be recognized in this way means a lot to me and to all of us who worked on the show. For that, I thank you from the bottom of my heart. Thanks.
Anthony Bourdain speaking about his trip to Gaza. And unfortunately, you didn't hear that anywhere or read that anywhere. And his passing is indeed a sad one. He contributed a lot. And if you ever watched his show, which I did at other people's homes, because I don't actually have television, I found it very enjoyable and very interesting the way he interacted with people in a very, I don't want to use the word humble, but in a certain humble way. This is Jeff Blankfort. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Week in Palestine.
طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. The purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham, and we continue it in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. This morning we confront one of the great injustices perpetrated by our criminal justice system, which systematic corruption is being exposed almost on a daily basis. But even in this climate, this case is extraordinary for its injustice. It exposes us. This morning we take a look at the conviction and incarceration of the Holy Land Foundation 5, It is but one story of the persecution of the Arab community in this country since 9/11. As Miko Peled describes in his new book, Injustice, The Story of the Holy Land Foundation 5, since 9/11, arrested members of the Arab community must prove themselves innocent rather than the government having to prove them guilty, the standard which relates to the rest of us. Different standards apply to those who have Arabic names. I personally witnessed this as executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Massachusetts during the 9/11 fallout in 2001. Following the Twin Towers attack, Arabic men throughout the country began to systematically be arrested and literally disappeared into the criminal justice system. Neither their families nor their attorneys knew where they were. They simply disappeared, by the thousands, for no other reason than they were Arabic. No one even knew where they were, much less the charges for the arrest. I remember meeting with a U.S. attorney in Boston with members of the Arabic legal community to try to get some answers from the government, some justification for these arrests, some information as to where they were being held, the charges for their arrest, and we simply could get no information about these disappeared men. That was the beginning of the post-9/11 legal persecution of the Arab community by the U.S. criminal justice system. The story you are about to hear about the conviction of the Holy Land Foundation 5 is a logical extension of that persecution, and it continues to happen here today. It is going on as we speak. You are about to hear Miko Peled describe the case of the Holy Land Foundation 5. Peled is the son of a prominent Israeli general who has become a courageous advocate for Palestinian liberation. Here is Miko Peled speaking at Seattle Pacific University.
My story is a little bit strange because I come from, like you heard, if you were to describe me, you describe me as an Israeli. I was born and raised there. My father was a general. I come from this very patriotic family. Today, when I talk about that country, I refuse to call it Israel. I think it should be called Palestine. And when I say this, then, you know, people are often shocked. Because it represents a very one-sided perspective. And having gone through this process that I describe in my book of as a journey of an Israeli into Palestine, I've reached a conclusion without any doubt at all in my mind that calling that country Israel is wrong. And we must all embrace the fact that it's Palestine. Now, the journey that I had gone through, this idea of a journey of an Israeli in Palestine, forces us to think about, first of all, what is Israel and what is Palestine? Is it one place or two? And the way it's portrayed quite often is that there's an Israel and there's a Palestine and there's a conflict. Like, there's a war. Some people call it a war. Well, that's another thing. Some people call it a war. But when there's a war, it usually means there's two armies fighting. But there's only one army there. It's the Israeli army. Palestinians never had an army. So it's not really a war. So is it one country or two? Is it one place or two? And then if you look at a map from before 1948, so a map that's maybe 75 or 100 years old, it says Palestine. If you look at maps today, it'll say Israel. And maybe some of it will say Palestine. It might have two names. So what's going on here? This is really confusing. The only way to get a good grasp of what is going on is to, you know, kind of do what I did, which is take that journey and to kind of talk to the people and to see the other side. And for me, the other side was Palestinians. So the country used to be called Palestine, now it's called Israel, and something in the happened that, you know, that created that reality. How does a country go from being called one thing to being called another thing? How is it that 100 years ago, or even less than 100 years ago, the vast majority of the people who lived there were Palestinians? It was considered an Arab country. Today, it's considered, a lot of people call it a Jewish country. How does that happen? That's kind of strange. So in my journey, what I realized was that I was living in this part of the country, which is Israel, where there are only Israeli Jews like myself, where the roads are always paved and it's very clean and very safe, and, you know, it's kind of living like here, very westernized, very modern. But 5 minutes away from where I was living, in a completely different reality, in a completely different sphere, were other people. They spoke a different language. They looked a little bit different. They dressed a little bit different. Their roads were full of potholes. It was always dusty. Everything is kind of arid and dry. It looked kind of like chaotic. We were told that it's very unsafe, that it's very dangerous to go there because they hate us. And I couldn't figure out, well, what's going on here? How could there be these two realities so close together in such a small place? Because the entire country is very small. Very, very small. And throughout this journey, which is very short geographically because it is a small country, I realized that what was created there was two different levels of reality, two different levels of existence. One for people like myself, and one for the Palestinians who are actually the natives of the land. Now, I was taught, and I'm sure many of you heard this, that Jews have a right to live in Israel because it's their ancient biblical homeland, that the Jews used to live there thousands of years ago, the ancient Hebrews, and then they were kicked out, and then they returned 2,000 years later. Which is a little bit strange. But what happened in the 2,000 years in between? What happened there? Who are the people that have lived there? How, you know, you look at pictures of Palestine from 100 years ago, you see cities, you see a lot of people, they're thriving, there's an economy, there are newspapers and movie theaters, and there's life. You look at pictures now, and you look at the Palestinian side, and it looks terrible. And you look at the Israeli side, and it looks really, really nice. Something happened in the process. And to me, that was really troubling. What happened in the process? How could the process that many of us, me, first of all, primarily, but everybody around in America and the West in general, consider to be a really good thing, a fair and just and positive thing, which is the so-called return of the Jews, how could it have created such a terrible reality for other people? What was the process? So, to, you know, fast forward to where we are today, as I look at it and what I saw and what I realized throughout this journey is that there are two narratives, there are two stories, there are two histories. And they can't both be right because they're diametrically opposed. One story talks about the right of the Jews to return and their heroic kind of resurgence into the world and having their own state and their own identity and so on. And the other one talks about massacres, forced exile, destruction, genocide. Well, these two stories can't live together. You have to pick one. And how do you pick one? The only way to pick one is to study and figure out for yourself which is true. And the reality that I found myself in is looking at the story that I was raised on and the history that I thought was true. I didn't think was true. I knew was true. Turned out to be a lie. So how do you wrap your head around that? The entire history that you learned, that your family was a part of, was a lie. And the story of the tragedy of the ethnic cleansing, of the destruction, of the massacres is true, and it was all caused by the people that I thought were the good guys, my people, including my family. So the Israeli army suddenly, in my eyes, went from being this glorious, heroic entity, you know, the descendants of King David, and, you know, that's kind of how it's always portrayed, to becoming war criminals and terrorists. That's a pretty sharp turn. And it messes you up for a while, you know, because you start questioning your identity and what's right and what's wrong, and, well, who am I in all of this then? Because if that's my family and everything I thought was right turns out to be wrong and I'm here, what's my role in all this? But the reality is the reality. And you have to, you either choose to accept it or you choose to deny it. You can't, you know, there's no compromising. When things are that extreme, there's no room for compromise. There's very little gray area. It's like you either accept racism or reject racism. There's no gray area. You accept violence or you reject violence. There's very little gray area. So I had to pick. And the more I engaged, the more I journeyed into Palestine, and Palestine, I realized, was really not just a little spot here and a little spot there, but the entire country, I realized that my existence there is a result of settler colonialism, ethnic cleansing, terrorism, and the reality in which Palestinians live is a result of that. So, I grew up in Jerusalem. But you know, you travel around the country, but particularly in Jerusalem, there are all these neighborhoods where we are told, there are all these beautiful houses that are called Arab homes. Now, growing up, we never said Palestinians, we said Arabs. A lot of Israelis still won't say the word Palestinian, they'll just say they're Arabs, which they are, but they're Arabs with a particular identity. And you see all these Arab homes, but there are no Arabs. They're all inhabited by Israelis. And nobody ever asked, and I didn't ask either, well, where are the Arabs? And by the way, why are there so many refugees in Gaza? Nobody asked that question. Why are there so many refugees in refugee camps around our country? And why are they so angry? Why do they hate us? Nobody ever makes that connection. Well, if these are Arab homes, and they're inhabited by Israelis, and over here you have a refugee camp of people that must have, if they're refugees, that means they must have been thrown out of somewhere, and they can't go back, and they're angry, it doesn't take a lot to figure out what happened. And then, when I was growing up, the part of Jerusalem in which I was raised, there are no Arabs, there are no Palestinians, not anywhere near. They weren't our neighbors, they didn't go to our schools, you know, it was complete segregation. There were no Arabs at all, no Palestinians at all. But there are all these Arab homes. All these neighborhoods with Arab homes, and there's Arabic writing on them, and you know they're kind of old and very beautiful, very distinct. And then I remembered, my mother told me a story when I was a kid, how she, when she was young, and she was born and raised in Jerusalem too, at one point in 1948, which is the war where Israel was established, she was offered to move into a home, into one of these Arab homes, and she refused. And the reason she refused is because that home used to belong to somebody else, to Palestinians. And she felt it was wrong to take the home of a family that was just kicked out. And I remember the story always bothered me. It always troubled me. There was something wrong about the story. I couldn't figure it out. Only later in life, when I was actually writing my book, I realized, wait a minute. I didn't know there were Arabs. There used to be Arabs here. There used to be Palestinians in this side, on this side of Jerusalem. We know there's another side of Jerusalem, because it was divided for many years, where there are Palestinians. But there are Palestinians on this side too. And then somebody mentioned Edward Said, for example, here and so forth. As I meet Palestinians living in, you know, all around the world, many of them talk about how they used to live in those homes. So in other words, they were thrown out by force, at gunpoint. And I'm sure you've heard the term ethnic cleansing. The part of Jerusalem that became the Jerusalem that I grew up in, that became a part of Israel, was very thoroughly, very effectively, you know, the result of ethnic cleansing. Not a single Palestinian family Not a single Palestinian person was left. They were all kicked out. And for most Israelis, that part of Jerusalem was Jerusalem because it was Israeli, we thought. We never thought about it, you know. It was just the Israeli part of Jerusalem. And then there's the Arab part of Jerusalem, which is East Jerusalem, which is very different. So, you know, you begin to come to terms with the fact that you're like the whites in the South here in the United States, or like the white people in South Africa. You know, you're the perpetrator, maybe not me personally, but the reality in which I live, and the people that I know were the perpetrators of a terrible crime, a war crime, ethnic cleansing, genocide, and so on. Now we're looking at a reality where the United States gives Israel something like almost $20 million a day. That's more money than any country, anybody gives anybody, I think, in the world. Think about it. That's a lot of money. Multiply it by, you know, 365 days. Multiply that year after year after year after year. And figure out how much money that is. It blows you away. I mean, the absurd amounts of money. And I grew up in Israel. Israel's not a poor country. It doesn't need foreign aid. I mean, there's some poor people, some rich people. You know, just like any other normal Western country. Why is it getting so much money? Why is it getting more money than, say, countries in Africa who really need it? And then you start looking at all the politics, and you start looking at the relationship between the countries, and then you start looking at American politics, and you see that there's this very strange connection, very, let's say, unhealthy relationship between these two countries. And then you look at the media, and then you look at the history books that you guys learn in school. And I had two boys who went through, you know, high school, they're in college, and then I have a daughter who's in high school now, and I look at what they're learning about that part of the world. And it's like, I want to scream. How can you possibly have all these people in this country learn the wrong thing about a country to which they give so much money? Why isn't the truth being exposed? Why don't Americans know that there's something very wrong going on there? And then I decide to do what I do, which is write books and talk and so forth. So that's the reality that I'm in. That's the reality from which I came. And when I talk to people here in America, it's really hard for them to hear this. Quite often it's very hard for them to hear this. Regardless if they're Jewish or not Jewish, if they're Arabs or not Arabs, regardless of that, describing the reality on the ground there the way I do is really, really hard for people to hear. Even young people like yourselves, because we all come from something. We've all heard about this. And some people feel very strongly about this. Most people feel very strongly about how important it is to support Israel, and that the Israelis are right, and the Arabs are terrorists, and so forth. And then you have to wonder, why in America do people think that Arabs are terrorists? Why is there such a negative view of Arabs in America? Who does it serve? When you look at Arab communities in America, when you look at Palestinian communities in Israel, when you look at the Arab world in general, you know, generally you see, you know, high levels of education, commitment to serving, commitment to being, you know, volunteering and, you know, helping the community and being a part of having a positive impact on the community, very low crime rates. What happened here? How did we end up with such a distorted view about the Arab world and about Arabs and about Muslims? And why? And these are questions that I'm throwing out. I'm not going to answer them, but I think these are things that are important for each and every one of you and the people beyond this class as well to look at. How did such positive communities that contribute so much, that are so highly educated, that have such low crime rates, suddenly become terrorists? Become associated with terrorism. Whether it's in Israel, maybe it makes kind of sense. In Palestine itself, maybe it's kind of, because there's an attempt there to kick them out, and you know they're the enemy. But why here? Why is there such a negative view of Palestinians and Arabs in general here in America? And then you know you start to connect the dots, and you see there's you begin to understand the reality in which we live, and why is it not represented fairly in the press? You know, there's this, you know, in Myanmar, we all hear about, you know, the genocide and what's going on there. Why don't we hear anything about Palestine? You know, students are up in arms about the lack of gun control in America and the massacres that we see in schools. This happens in Palestine. Israelis do this in Palestine all the time. 17 people being killed in a school for Palestinians is, it's just a day in the life of. You know, there's a Palestinian girl who's not much younger than you guys, who's in prison because she pushed out, kicked out a bunch of soldiers from her house. She's been in prison for 3 months without a trial, and she's facing a very long prison sentence while once she is tried. Her name's Ahed Tamimi. Maybe you heard about her. Why doesn't anybody say anything about that? You know, all the Me Too movement, all the rights of women, and women should be allowed to, you know, fight back, and abusing women, and, you know, and all that is so important here. Here's a girl who's 17 years old. She was 16 when it happened. Armed soldiers invaded her house, invaded her room. She kicked them out, literally, and slapped one of the officers, which is exactly what she should have done. You know, I have a daughter. I would hope my daughter would have the courage to do just that if men were invading her space and her home. She's in jail for that. You know? So these are things that are important that I think need to be looked at. Now, I'll tell you a little bit about my new book. The new book, which just came out, Injustice, is in a way kind of answers a lot of these questions, because that is a story of something that has taken place here in the United States. So Palestinians are being persecuted and killed by Israelis. In a way, it makes sense. Whether you agree with it or not, it makes sense, because, you know, there's this reality over there, very violent reality going on over there. But why here? And then one day I heard the story about five Palestinian Muslims who are in federal prison. And these guys were part of a charity organization, a relief organization that was called the Holy Land Foundation. And the Holy Land Foundation was at one point the largest Muslim charity organization in America. So they raised funds mostly for to help Palestinians in need, but they also helped in other places. They helped after the Oklahoma City bombing. You guys must have heard of that. They provided relief after 9/11. They provided relief wherever there were natural, you know, disasters, floods, earthquakes, here in the U.S., around the world. They're very active. And they were highly regarded and respected charity. And then, after 9/11, a few months after 9/11, President George Bush came out and closed them down and announced that they are a designated terrorist organization, a terrorist funding organization. In other words, that all their money was being given to terrorism or to terrorist organizations, and therefore they had to be closed down. So they were closed down, all their money, all their assets were frozen, and they were designated themselves a terrorist organization. Now, the United States has a process where they designate organizations or people as terrorists, and then they are on the list. So after 9/11, everybody thought, well, obviously the government's panicking. Obviously the government's got to show that they're doing something. So they just round up the usual suspects, and it'll all blow over. It'll be fine. And when the government does something like that, we as citizens have the right to sue the government and say, excuse me, you made a mistake. This is wrong. We're not a terrorist organization. We want our money back, and we want the designation as a terrorist organization to be taken away. We did nothing wrong. So they hired lawyers, some very good lawyers, and they sued the government. And when the government does something like this, they have to go to court and show, you know, what's the proof? It's called an administrative record with all the proof that the government has against you or against them. And all they had were photocopies of faxes that were sent by the government of Israel. They didn't have any statements under oath, nothing that was notarized. They had a few translations of documents that turned out to be wrong, and a few newspaper articles. Just a really weak case. No real concrete evidence. So the defense team put together all the evidence to show that these guys did nothing wrong. Every penny that they raised, you could show, see exactly where it went. And it all went to charity. It all went to relief. So they thought, this is going to be an easy case. So they went to court. And feeling very confident. And the judge dismissed the case and struck all the evidence from the file. So none of their evidence could count, and the case was dismissed. And they couldn't believe it. How could a judge just dismiss the case and strike the evidence? Well, she did. Now, this is kind of crazy anyway, but one thing that was particularly crazy about it was that there was a particular document in the administrative record where the guy that managed their office in Jerusalem, because they were dealing with Palestine, right, says that, yes, they did give money to Hamas, which is considered a terrorist organization in the United States. So the lawyers thought, okay, this is a problem. If their own manager on the ground says that they gave money to Hamas, then they're supporting a terrorist organization, right? Because here in the United States, Hamas was designated as a terrorist organization. Hamas is a Palestinian, you know, Islamic resistance movement. Now, that particular guy was arrested by the Israelis. So the lawyers here contacted his lawyer back there. And she said, what are you talking about? I have all of his statements. He never said anything of the kind. So she faxed all of his statements. And they went to a translation firm where they had done the translation and notarized it, signed under oath. And he said exactly the opposite. He said, we had never given any money to Hamas. We do not support any political organization, any military organization, all we do is relief. Now, the correct translation was in the file with the evidence that was struck out. The wrong translation remained because that was in the government's file. So how do you proceed from there? How do you go from there? I mean, the lawyers just couldn't figure out what was going on. Because there are laws and regulations that are supposed to protect citizens who are innocent, right? And the judge just struck it all out. So they appealed. And the appellate court said, look, the judge shouldn't have done this. This was wrong. But this is not a normal case. This is a case of national security, and therefore, we're going to leave it. And suddenly these lawyers, and I spoke to them, I talk about them in the book, you know, these are serious, seasoned human rights lawyers that have been doing this work for a long time. They're blown away. They couldn't figure out what was going on. How could this happen in America where the justice system is supposed to protect us, where there are laws and regulations and rules that are supposed to protect innocent people? And then it dawned on them. And all the lawyers that were involved that I spoke to said the same thing. After 9/11, there was a reality here where Muslims and Arabs, cannot get a fair trial. Instead of being innocent, presumed innocent until proven guilty, it was the other way around. They're presumed guilty, and then it's up to them to prove their innocence, even though the reality was that they're not even given that opportunity. So you have to wonder, what's going on in America? Is the justice system corrupt, politicized, or is it pure and clean and just the way it's supposed to be? Are there political prisoners in America? Is there a problem with political persecution in America? Because most people think there isn't. Most people think this is a real democracy. So what's going on? Then what the government did is they started preparing a criminal trial against these guys. And the lawyers thought, why a criminal trial? They did nothing wrong. Their taxes were in order. Their papers were in order. Every dime that they got was accounted for. What could they possibly charge them with? It was clear that they didn't give money to Hamas. They didn't give money to terrorism. What could you possibly charge them with? And the problem was this. The president of the United States said that these people are terrorists. The president of the United States shut down the organization and said that that is a designated terrorist funding network. Now everybody's got to prove that the president was right. The fact the president said it, even though he had no proof, is a problem. But now he said it. So the government has to do everything it possibly can to quickly create a case. So then they said, well, you know what? They actually didn't give money to terrorism. That's right. But because they gave money to help poor Palestinians, that in a roundabout way helped the terrorists. And so that's why they gave what is called material support. Material support means they gave stuff. They gave some kind of support that in the end ended up helping terrorism. And that's what they went to trial with. They went to trial saying, well, they didn't give money directly to Hamas. They gave money to others, and that helped Hamas. So they said, well, the two main examples were this. One was that they were helping orphans. Now, you got to hear this to believe this. I mean, it's beyond belief. They had a program where they're helping Palestinian orphans. Now, why are there so many Palestinian orphans? Because Israel was killing a lot of Palestinians. So there was a serious orphan problem. So they said, you see, the reason these kids are orphans is because their fathers were terrorists. So if you're going to help these orphans, you're not only supporting the terrorists, you're encouraging more people to become terrorists. So the theory was, well, if you're a father and you know your family is going to be taken care of, then of course you're going to join a terrorist group and blow yourself up, right? I mean, wouldn't you do it? All of us? Anyone would do this, right? Makes perfect sense. And they had real experts. People who sit on think tanks in Washington, D.C. say this. It's well known that if somebody knows their family is going to be taken care of, then of course they're going to join a terrorist organization. That makes perfect sense. Now, besides the fact that that's utterly racist and complete nonsense, they took a look at the actual cause of death of the fathers of these orphans. And not a single one died as a result of what you might call terrorism. Not a single one. And then what I did, I took a look at the list of Palestinians who participated in what was called suicide missions, which is something that hasn't been happened in a very long time, but there were several years where that was a big problem. None of them had children. So either way you look at it, the orphans did not become orphans as a result of terrorism. So supporting these orphans has nothing to do with that. But in the court of law, this stuck. And this was permitted. Then the other thing they were saying, well, they were helping the families of Palestinian prisoners. Israel has thousands and thousands of Palestinian prisoners, which they call terrorists. So I took a look, and you can see, if you look at the list of the Palestinians that are held by Israeli jails and what they were charged with, the vast majority were never charged with acts of violence. They're all political prisoners. We're talking about the families of political prisoners, not terrorists. So even in that, it has nothing to do with supporting their families is not supporting terrorism. Supporting their families, supporting the families of political prisoners. What could be wrong with that? So that was the kind of case that the government presented. And it took two trials. The first trial, they weren't able to convict. The second trial, they convicted all of them. And these are five men who are sitting now, as we speak, in federal prisons. And they received sentences from 15 to 65 years. From 15 to 65 years in federal prison. So when I heard the story, my first reaction was, well, it doesn't make sense. So then I looked into it. I started meeting their families. I started communicating with them in prison. You can email people in jail. And then this whole world of what I thought was unbelievable stuff, you know, was exposed to me. And which is why I decided to write this book. Now, the two things that people don't believe when I tell them the story, number one is that the justice system can be so corrupt and politicized. That every judge along the way, all the juries along the way, the appellate courts along the way, everybody had agreed that these guys have to go to jail, even though all the evidence showed that they did nothing wrong. As Americans, people don't want to believe it, and you can't blame them for not wanting to believe it, but they just don't want to believe it. That the justice system could be so one-sided, so unfair, and so corrupt. The other thing is that Americans have a hard time accepting is that there are political prisoners in America. There is political persecution in America. And it didn't start now. If you learn a little bit about the history of blacks in America, about the Black Panthers, and so forth, you see that this is something that's already been going on. The black community in America is fully aware that there is political persecution and political prisoners in America. So it started way back then.
Yeah. What year was this?
What year was what?
This?
It started after 9/11. So it started in like 2001. So it started in 2001. By 2009, they were all convicted and in jail. The process was a lengthy process. So I want to read to you a couple of things that that are in the book that I think are... let me tell you the names of the guys. I think that's important too. The name of these five men, okay? Abdurrahman Odeh. He's from, they're all Palestinians. They're all Palestinians who immigrated here to America as students. He's in for 15 years in federal prison. And Muhammad al-Mazain, 15 years in federal prison.
Are any of those Palestinian Americans now, they have citizenship here too?
Most of them do, yeah.
Most of them do.
Only one of them, he was in the process while this happened, so he never got the citizenship. And now it's a problem. Mufid Abdul-Qadir got 20 years. Shukri Abu Bakr got 65 years, and Ghassan Elashi got 65 years. And I was able to meet four of them in prison. For the fifth one, Ghassan Elashi, for some reason, the prison authorities would not permit me to see him. I don't know why. Because when you go to visit a prisoner, you have to apply and so forth. And they have to approve you, and then you're placed on a list of approved visitors. Now, when you hear a story, certain things kind of stick in your mind. Certain impressions just stick in your mind. So I want to describe a couple of things to you that stuck in my mind. I'm going to read them because I want to get them just the way they're in the book. Now, they were actually arrested. They're actually arrested in 2004. So, there's a process there. And this is one of the impressions that stuck in my mind. 20-year-old Zaira Abu Bakr was still in bed in her parents' home when she heard the banging on the front door. She looked at her phone and noticed several missed calls and a message from her friend, Noor Elashi. She opened the message from Noor first, and it contained one word, Aju. Aju in Arabic means, they came. In other words, there was something that they were anticipating for many, many years. And when it actually happened, all she had to say was, basically, it's here. They came. So she didn't have to explain who they were. She didn't have to explain when they came, where they came, what they wanted. It was absolutely clear. And what it was, really, is in the following description. At precisely 7 a.m. Central Time, on July 27, 2004, the homes of Shukri Abu Bakr, Ghassan Elashi, Mufid Abdul-Qadir, Abdurrahman Odeh, and Muhammad al-Mazain were raided by local and federal officers. All five men, who became known as the Holy Land Foundation Five, were taken into custody. 4 years and two trials later, all five were sent to federal prison, serving sentences ranging from 15 to 65 years. Holy Land Foundation was at one time the largest Muslim charity organization in America. And on December the 4th, 2001, it was shut down by President George Bush without due process using a presidential executive order. Federal agents raided the charity's offices and seized all the documents, assets, and funds of the organization, as well as personal property of the employees. Now, all the documents that were taken were classified, so the defense didn't have access to them. So when the government said such and such a thing took place, the defense did not have access to the same documents. They also learned that these guys' phones were tapped. And all of their conversations were transcribed. And because they were Arabs, they spoke Arabic, and so they had to be translated. Well, all of that was classified, and they did not have access to that either. So it was very hard for the defense to argue anything, because who knows what was translated and how it was translated, and many of the things were translated wrong. And I want to tell you just a little bit, something personal about, not all of them, but a couple of them. So the first one that I was involved with was Shukri. He was the CEO of the charity. And he's the first one I communicated with. And I dedicated the book to his daughter, Sanabil. And so I'm going to read you a couple of the emails that he sent to me, just so you get an idea of what kind of person he was. He wrote to me, Miko, we're out of lockdown this morning. I took advantage of my solitude to finish up some important readings that included revising my memorization of the Quran and an introduction to neuro-linguistic programming. And then he says, the first book I read in the first months of my incarceration, where I was in solitary for 3 months, was Man's Search for Meaning by Dr. Viktor Frankl. It's a very well-known book. I don't know if you've ever heard of it. He illuminated his secret to Holocaust survival, how to turn one's predicament into human achievement, and how man's main concern is not to gain pleasure or avoid pain, but to seek meaning in his life. And then he talked about his daughter, Sanabil. He said, with Sanabil out there fighting 3 chronic killers, holding on as strong as she could, waiting for her daddy to come home was heartbreaking. I knew I wasn't coming home anytime soon. Then about a year later, he wrote to me the following email. He said, Sanabil is on her deathbed fighting for her life. She was born very ill, and so she was ill her whole life. At this point, she's 25, 26. Please keep her in your thoughts. Her mission on earth is about finished. She says she won't go before she can see me. And I said, baby, I'll always be with you no matter where or when you go. And then a few days after that email, he sent me the following email. In the name of Allah, the most merciful, the most compassionate, Sanabil passed away on Tuesday, May 14, 2013, at 2 a.m. She went peacefully and gracefully. She will be buried today. I praise Allah for what he had allowed me to keep, my remaining daughters, and my wonderful wife, Wujdan. And of course, the prison authorities didn't allow him to see his daughter one last time before she died. So this is the kind of reality, this is the kind of personal tragedy that this case represents. So we've got this bigger story, you know, Israel-America relationship, which is all the politics of Israel and Palestine and how the United States is involved with that. Then you've got the whole judicial issue, the court system, the judges, the justice system that turned against them. And then you've got a very, very, very heartbreaking personal story. And each one of them has a personal story that's similar to that, you know, that's kind of like that. And what I try to do is touch on all of them because they're all important. We need to really feel the just how tragic this was and what effect it had on the people and the community. Like I said, the Arab and Muslim community, and particularly the Palestinian community. And then understand how the justice system works and when it doesn't function and the politics that are behind this. You know, people often ask me, so how's it going to end? Well, there were 2 trials, at the end of which they were all found guilty and they were all convicted. They went to the appellate court. The appellate court agreed that there were a lot of mistakes made by during the trials, but they upheld the decision of the judges, and so they didn't do anything. The Supreme Court refused to hear the case. And then before President Obama left office, there was an attempt to try to get him to commute their sentences and deport them. And there were several countries that were willing to accept them and give them citizenship. Because the common knowledge is, outside of, I guess, the courtroom in Texas where they were convicted, is that these men did nothing wrong. And this case was an incredible miscarriage of justice. So there were several countries that were willing to accept them and give them citizenship, but President Obama wouldn't do it. He wasn't willing to do it. And I didn't think he would. You know, when the process was going on, some people asked me if I thought he would do it. I said, no, he's not going to do it. You know, there's not an American president alive that would commute the sentences of 5 convicted Palestinians, you know, convicted on terrorism charges. So what's going to happen? Nobody knows. I mean, I wrote this book hoping that, you know, people would read it and there would be some kind of an outcry saying, this is a terrible injustice, let's do something. Because you know what typically happens in cases like this is that 100 years later, somebody apologizes. And then they erect a little statue for them, like Sacco and Vanzetti. Some of us are old enough to, you know, the case of Sacco and Vanzetti, you know, two immigrants that were, you know, wrongly charged of murder. Then 100 years later, some governor says, oh, this was a terrible injustice, and let's put a little statue in their memory. Well, they're dead now. Nobody cares. So that something will happen while these guys are still alive and so forth. And I think that their status as political prisoners is exactly the same as Palestinians who are held by Israel in Israeli jails, who are also political prisoners. And I don't think any of them are going to be released until all of Palestine becomes Palestine again, until all of Palestine is free and Palestinians can live and the country is called Palestine again, the way I believe it should be called. So that seems a pretty daunting reality because, you know, Israel is a very strong country with a lot of support. Israel does not want Palestine to become Palestine again, certainly. Most Americans agree with Israel, so this seems pretty hopeless. But things do change if we want them to change, if we work hard enough. And when I say we, I mean each and every single one of us here and in other classrooms and other places around the world where I talk about this and other people talk about this. The spin that I wear that says BDS represents a movement that calls to impose boycott sanctions on Israel until such time that Israel complies with international law that allows for freedom for Palestinians, equal rights for Palestinians, releases political prisoners, and so on. So if anybody here is interested in freedom and injustice and that sort of thing and feels that they stand on the side that opposes racism and opposes violence, then I would invite all of you to take a look into that. Go online, Google BDS Palestine, and get involved and get engaged, because so much of our money, all of our money here, goes there, and so much of that money, well, I would say all of that money, goes to impose a terrible injustice and a terrible tragedy on the Palestinian people, that all of us are really responsible, whether we like it or not, for the injustice. We all have a hand in it because it's our money. So unless we stand up and say, no, you can't have our money if you're going to use that, we're not going to elect you, we're not going to vote for you if you give that money to Israel, then we're all complicit. It's absurd reality where we're guilty of something even though we did nothing, but by doing nothing, we're guilty.
You have been listening to Mikko Peled expose the rank injustice of our criminal justice system in an examination of the persecution of the Holy Land Foundation 5. And as President Trump continues to appoint conservative judges throughout the federal judiciary, we can expect things to only get worse. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. And this is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. We preview the Bilderberg Conference. In fact, we look at the technical aspects of it. Quantum computing, artificial intelligence, and the end of work at last week's Bilderberg Conference in Turin, Italy. Two of the freelance journalists covering that conference were Marco and Maria for We Are Change Rotterdam. We hear their views on the significance of the technology they're discussing behind closed doors, much of it developed under wraps by the US military. And the politicians who are there, like our own Amber Rudd, get a strong message as to who's really in charge. Yes, it's the tech giants, not the people. So what's this technology all about, and why is the 5G so-called smart grid being trialled here in Bristol and Sheffield before it's rolled out across the UK in the next couple of years? Why is 5G so crucial to this technological change? Will it bring in a utopia or a dystopia? And what are the health dangers? Why has nobody been asked whether we want this or not? Also, more atrocities in Yemen every week. We look at one powerful arm of the Israel lobby, the B'nai B'rith. Who are they and what's their real agenda? Who better to answer that question than the lawyer son of the American Jewish boycott lawyer, the Committee for Nazi Germany, Anton Chaykin, plus Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. Our sister show Dialects back on BCFM 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. Catch it online now at dialectradio.co.uk. This week, we go to a People's Republic of Stokes Croft and look at the Bear Pit particularly, but also a series of documentaries that they're putting on there. And also look at a meeting coming up at the Ark Bar in Broad Street about anti-Semitism and Islamophobia. Now, we start this week, though, Martin, by looking at the events over in Singapore about North Korea and also the possible implications for what's going on in the Middle East.
Well, as I said in the first hour, I'm guardedly optimistic about this. At least they're talking. That's better than...
Has Trump actually got anything out of this deal?
Well, what he's got out of it is it's softened his image slightly. So there are positive PR aspects to this for him.
But, I mean, has he actually got anything? It looks to me as if the real winners, are North Korea, because the Americans have now agreed not to have any exercises of invading North Korea.
Well, I mean...
What has Trump got out of it?
Well, what he's got out of it, as I say, is a slightly softening of his PR image. And, of course, they're still quite belligerent towards everybody else. So they're being nice to the North Koreans, but they're being horrible to everybody else. They're being horrible to the Iranians, they're being horrible to the Europeans, they're being horrible to the Chinese, they're being horrible to the Russians. So being nice to the North Koreans, who are not very popular anyway, doesn't really change very much in the big scheme of things.
So was it all just for the cameras?
Yes, basically, from Trump's point of view, it's essentially a PR. From Kim Jong-un's point of view, it's a life-or-death thing. And I think the real winners here are the South Koreans, because they've the Democratic Party in South Korea, which is the left-wing party in South Korea, have basically managed to finesse this into being. And they've played Trump very cleverly. The right wing in South Korea are going and gnashing their teeth because they don't want this cancellation of these exercises. But if you think about it, it's perfectly logical. These exercises basically are practicing attacking North Korea. They're doing the same sort of thing in the Baltic states and in Eastern Europe and in relation to Russia.
Now,
if you carry on doing stuff like that, it's bound to put people on edge, isn't it?
Well, one of the best journalists on the planet, I think, fair to say that, is Robert Fisk. He's worked for The Times, now for The Independent. And why do we hear nothing of him on the BBC, even though he's one of the best and most, I suppose, authoritative analysts in the world?
Well, it's because, as you well know, the mainstream basically blackballs people who don't play by their rules, and he's somebody who's a genuinely independent.
I was listening on Irish radio. He said, "Well, it's because when the BBC phoned me up, they say, well, if we were to have you as an interviewee, what would you say about this?" And he says, "Well, I'll tell you live what I'll say, but I'm not going to discuss it all beforehand." Mm. That does strike me as a little bit worrying. Is if someone phones you up to do an interview and then says they want to know first what you're going to say. So then they may decline the interview, depending on your point of view.
Well, they ought to be able to work it out from reading his stuff. The fact of the matter is that the BBC is to some extent controlled by the government and very much terrified of the Israeli lobby.
I mean,
Fisk is going to be somebody who's going to say
Robert
things
Fisk
that are going to annoy those people.
Resigned from the Times not long after Rupert Murdoch took it over. Something very strange has happened to British journalism when one of the greatest journalists in the world, who happens to be British, is not seen or heard on the BBC.
Well, that's because the mainstream is a dream factory for the masses. It's not there to tell them things they're not supposed to be thinking about.
Well, let's have a listen now to Robert Fisk being interviewed by Jeff Blankfort from a radio station in California about Trump.
Yes. You said I resigned from the Times in opposition to Rupert Murdoch's purchase of the paper. That is not true. Rupert Murdoch had purchased the paper many years before. I resigned from the Times because they declined to publish a front-page story, which they originally wanted to, saying that an Iranian Airbus had been shot down over the Gulf, this is in 1988, by an American warship because the American captain had panicked. They preferred to run an editorial saying that the pilot of the Iranian passenger plane was a suicide pilot, which wasn't true. And inquiry by the U.S. did prove indeed that the American warship crew had been panicking as they fired at the passenger aircraft. As a result of that, the Times did not carry my story, which was true, although Irish papers did, and I resigned from the Times and joined the Independent. It was nothing to do with Murdoch himself, though, of course, his influence was very obviously over the paper.
Well, thank you for clarifying that and recalling that story. The USS Vincennes shot down the Iranian passenger plane. It's a story we don't hear about, and thanks for bringing it up. You know, Tuesday's 11 in Singapore with Kim Jong-un has been grabbing the headlines and monopolizing our airwaves. And I've been feeling this may be a sideshow to make Americans less aware of what's happening in the Middle East, which we've been writing about with regard to Iran and Syria. What's your take on that?
Well, it's interesting you put it that way, because a very dear colleague of mine made the point yesterday while watching this nonsense on television that this might be about Iran. This might be a way of being able to push the American line that Iran is the dangerous nuclear power by showing that, in fact, it's possible to defang, as the Americans like to say, North Korea's nuclear powers. It's interesting that the man who is prepared to talk to a tyrant who has nuclear weapons, not just wants to develop them, but who's got nuclear weapons, and who carries out atrocious human rights abuses, that Trump should be prepared to talk to him, but to actually tear up an agreement which has prevented Iran from manufacturing nuclear weapons, and of course having no interest at all in talking to the Iranians.
Well, I think that's probably right. I mean, I think there's been an executive decision at the top in the US that they're probably only going to go to war with Iran to help keep the Israelis happy. And if you're going to do that, you've just got to put the North Korean thing on ice.
But what about this utter hypocrisy when it comes to Iran and Israel, where you've got Israel committing horrific human rights, racist human rights abuses, a form of genocide, what with the attack on Gaza a few years ago by artillery and by aircraft, and more recently Israeli soldiers shooting dead 130 or so peaceful protesters and wounding over 5,000 people, including killing medics, killing journalists. I mean, that's a human rights abusing regime with nuclear weapons that's Trump's friend, and yet he's torn up this agreement with Iran. I mean, this seems to be absolutely ridiculous and not being... I mean, it really is. It's an object of ridicule, surely. If we had Spitting Image on, this would be on the telly, or Rory Bremner or whatever on the TV as a satirical programme, just literally making fun of Trump for this utter hypocrisy. And yet he's ripping up a deal which has supposedly stopped the Iranians even thinking about developing nuclear weapons. Obviously, they're thinking about it, but doing it.
Yeah, well, I mean, all along, it's not been about Iran's nuclear weapons. It's about the regime itself anything the Iranians did to keep the Americans happy is obviously a waste of time, because ultimately the Israelis and the Israeli lobby in the US want the regime in Iran removed. And as you mentioned there, the Israelis have got hundreds of nuclear weapons completely illegally. And in actual fact, under the low, I can't remember the name of the act in the US, those who proliferate nuclear weapons, all aid and trade should automatically be cut off from them. And that's why the Israelis won't admit in public that they've got these nuclear weapons, because there's legislation in the US which would immediately bring sanctions to bear on them. And of course there's been no sanctions on Israel. They've got US military embedded now inside Israel, and they receive massive subsidies. They receive the lion's share of the US foreign aid budget, even though they're a first world country. And that money doesn't go to the Palestinians, it goes to the Israelis to pay for all sorts of military equipment, which of course they buy from the US military industrial complex. So the US taxpayer subsidizes their own military industrial complex via the Israelis. And of course they are very dangerous, and they want a war, and we should be talking about this, because the British have got to decide, do we want a war with Iran? Because I don't think we do, and if we don't, we need to speak up now.
What about this airliner that Robert Fisk was talking about right at the start there? In 1988, a US warship shot down an Iranian airliner and mistook it for an F-14 fighter. They killed 300 people. It was flying from Iran to Dubai.
Well, I mean, it was a horrific incident at the time, and of course the Americans tried to wriggle out of it and say that they didn't do it and it was all the Iranians' fault and so on.
Well, it was Iran Air Flight 655, and it was on the 3rd of July 1988. The USS Vincennes just shot it down in cold blood.
Yeah, well, what you had going on at the time there was the Iran-Iraq War.
A scheduled flight on normal flight plan?
Yeah, we had the Iran-Iraq War going on there, and if you remember, there was the tanker war going on, where the Iraqis, with support from the West, were attacking Iranian oil tankers, and then of course the Iranians were responding by attacking Iraqi oil tankers, but the Iraqi oil tankers were being protected by the US. And so all of these things have been going on for years, and you know, it's just incidents like this can easily escalate into all-out war. They haven't, because, you know, born by good luck and good management, they haven't. But the possibility is always there. And, of course, the US has also deliberately done things to make the Iranians unhappy. I think in this case it was probably accidental, but they've actually supported terrorists to go inside Iran and kill loads of people. The Israelis have assassinated loads of US Iranian nuclear scientists, for example, and boasted about it. If the Iranians were to do anything like that, everybody would be screaming terrorism, terrorism, terrorism. But then when they do it, it's just, well, you know, that's the sort of thing we do.
News in Haaretz, the Israeli newspaper this week, that Israel sold advanced weapons to Myanmar, that's Burma, during an anti-Rohingya ethnic cleansing campaign. Israeli-made Navy patrol boats, custom-fitted with remote weapon stations, are part of arms deals estimated to be worth tens of millions of dollars.
Well, I mean, they've got their own military-industrial complex in Israel now, developed with US resources. And, of course, the problem with the military-industrial complex is to make, you know, it's there to sell stuff. And the Israelis, you know, are quite happy to sell stuff. They've been very involved in Latin America, for example, supporting various unsavory regimes there over the years. I remember when I was in Colombia on a trade union delegation a few years ago, there's Colombian army soldiers, you know, guarding this place. I was looking at the rifles. I don't recognise that rifle. What's that rifle? And I said to the local guys, you know, what's that rifle? I said, it's a Galil rifle, Israeli rifle. And of course, they've been very involved in, you know, supporting the military in Latin America, who've been very much torturing and killing their own people. And the Israelis have been very involved in that.
So the British also sell lots of arms to the Israelis, don't they? But, I mean, looking at the Israeli military, we've really got to ask questions. His ex-spy chief said the fun part about Mossad is that it's a crime organisation. But apparently Netanyahu is not amused. This is another article in Haaretz this week. Former Mossad chief Tamir Pardo has said it's a crime operation with a licence. So I suppose that's almost like the James Bond licence to kill kind of thing. Netanyahu has responded, Mossad is a glorious organisation.
Well, you pay your money and you take your choice. What's the truth? The truth is that it's a very dangerous and ruthless organisation which engages in terrorism and assassination and then wants a pat on the back for it. But of course, as we go into World War III, it might be that all of this belligerence is going to lead to consequences which those involved have not contemplated.
Netanyahu addressed the report, which was published last week, and accused him of asking the former head of the Shin Bet security service to listen to the telephone conversations of the then IDF chief. So this is the Prime Minister spying on the head of the army.
Well, historically, the army in Israel has tended to be less belligerent than the politicians. That's not always true, but, you know, and in actual fact, it's only a matter of degree. But, you know, in the past, one has looked to Israeli Defence Force figures to be a voice of moderation to some extent. But I'm afraid Israeli society as a whole is becoming more and more paranoid and psychopathic. And Netanyahu is very much, you know, feeding that and feeding off it. And the possibility of some stupid, reckless provocation is very much on the table.
I mean, this hatred of the Arabs and the Muslims, is it too much to draw comparisons with the racial hatred in Nazi Germany?
I think that they get offended when people use this kind of comparison, but it's a perfectly legitimate comparison. Yuri Avery, who's very good, he's an old guy now, he's very good, used to be a terrorist, used to kill British soldiers, but he's very much on the peace camp now. He says, well, you know, within Israeli politics, people accuse each other of being Nazis as, you know, it's just normal knockabout stuff. I don't think it makes much sense to compare different situations, but the Gaza situation, it looks very similar to something like the Warsaw Ghetto, for example. It's not a concentration camp, but it's not a holiday camp either, is it? Let's face it.
Situation gets worse, really, all the time, doesn't it, over there? It almost as if the international community gives Benjamin Netanyahu a pat on the back. Every atrocity that happens, the latest series of atrocities are the soldiers shooting the unarmed protesters at the Gaza border. It almost encourages him to do something more.
Well, that's right. I mean, and don't forget, he's himself under investigation for various frauds and malfeasances, and he's got a personal interest in directing everybody's attention to get, you know, he's managed to get Jerusalem recognised as the capital by Trump, and he's keen on a war with Iran. I mean, people shouldn't kid themselves. Netanyahu was here not long ago in Britain talking to Theresa May
last week,
and he will have been saying war with Iran, war with Iran, war with Iran, and of course, we're not told this. The media, you know, the media in this country don't really talk about it that much because it's actually, they know that it's about as popular as Ebola.
I mean,
they do have demos
over in Israel which aren't reported here quite a lot, actually, where people come out on the streets and protest against their government, but also, of course, pro the racists. So in the Israeli towns this week, residents have taken to the streets in their hundreds to protest the sale of a house to Arabs. The racism of ethnic superiority has become a legitimate reality under this right-wing government, says Bethan McKern at The Independent yesterday. The deputy mayor of the northern Israeli town of Afula has joined a demonstration calling for a house in the community not to be sold to undesirable Arabs.
Well, the other thing that's happened is that there was a motion in the Knesset that all citizens of Israel should be equal. That is to say that Jewish and non-Jewish residents of Israel should have equal rights. And it was struck down, I believe, by the Supreme Court. Because any Jew from anywhere in the world, from Argentina, from America, from Britain, can go to Israel and immediately become a citizen. Whereas Palestinian families who've lived in the place in the region for generations live in refugee camps in places like Jordan and Lebanon. And they can't leave the refugee camps because they've got no documentation. They're stateless people, and you know, this is simply outrageous, and it's been going on for years. And of course, the Israelis have got away with all of this because the rest of the world basically turned a blind eye. But ultimately, when you've got war breaking out, you know, the attempts to partition Syria and so on and so forth, the existence of states as they are now is not necessarily going to carry on. And I think if we go to World War III, two states which are most likely to be eliminated by the end of that war will be Saudi Arabia and Israel, because neither of them have a legitimate basis to exist.
What about boycotts? Because that's one way that people can, I suppose, from, you know, if the government won't intervene, and we'll be hearing a bit more about that in a minute, a British government in a situation like this and making its views felt about racism and genocide, then by boycotting Israeli goods, that's one way you can do something. Do you think that's ethically acceptable?
Well, I think it is ethically acceptable. Of course, the model for this is what was done with the South Africans, where when the big municipalities in the US, Chicago, New York, etc., withdrew their municipal funds from investing in South Africa, that's when they crumbled. But in actual fact, what's happened as a result of that is that laws have been passed in the US and elsewhere that say that anybody even suggesting boycott of Israel should lose that, you know, that they will be punished for suggesting it. And therefore, the whole strategy of boycott, which I'm totally in favour of, has been undermined by changes in the law to make it difficult for people to carry out boycotts. And that's because the Israelis have lobbied to make sure that that's the case.
One of the supermarkets in Britain that carries Israeli goods is Waitrose. And I spoke to campaigner Esther Giles earlier on, just the end of last week, about this very subject, and she's saying that some of the dates that you can buy in Waitrose, she's been writing to Waitrose asking them to stop stocking them, but they keep deleting her comments that she makes on the Waitrose website, and they're refusing now to reply to her emails.
The Palestine Solidarity Campaign has been working for a number of years and identifying supermarkets to sell produce that come from Israel. So I decided to have a little look in my local supermarket, Waitrose in Westbury-on-Trim, to see whether there were any Israeli products on their shelves.
Now, well, anyone can do this, can't they, for any supermarket?
Have a little look. And if you go in, you can usually see, well, usually or always, the country of origin is listed. If you look carefully at the labels. And so I knew that I should look for things like medjool dates, because many, many medjool dates come from Israel, and in particular from the occupied territories, some oranges, some other citrusy type fruits. So I went to have a little look at the labels. I also had a little look online at the Waitrose online store to see what I could spot that had come from Israel. And so I've identified a number of products which I know definitely or probably come from Israel. Now, I address this in a number of ways. So first of all, on the customer product reviews, on dates, I posted a comment that actually I'm really shocked that Waitrose is stocking products like medjool dates from Israel, but they wouldn't actually post the comment. They said it breached their guidelines.
Well, hang on a minute, that's just a fact.
Yes. But obviously I wasn't surveying the quality of the product. I was making a political point, and they said that they don't get engaged in political discussion.
Okay.
So the other thing I did was to write to them separately from that, to make a number of points to them about the occupation, about the aggressive settlement tactics of the government, and wouldn't it be reasonable for Waitrose, being an ethically oriented company, to stand for the human rights of the Palestinians and refuse to stock Israeli products? The other thing I did is I went into the store and personally made a complaint to customer services, pointing out the specific products I'd identified on the store. I got the same comments from everybody. And in fact, when I complained in the shop, I was literally shaking with anger because I was so shocked that they're selling this stuff. And I went up onto the customer services desks and said, I am angry. What they did is they recorded my complaint and said they would forward it to customer services, which they did. But I have heard nothing back. I've encouraged friends and colleagues to write to Waitrose and other supermarkets and suggest the sorts of products they need to be looking for. But you're right, Tony, it needs to be coordinated a little bit better than one person randomly writing
okay.
to Waitrose.
Dates, oranges, what else should we be checking the origin of?
Passion fruit, pomegranates, Sharon fruits. Now, there are two, interestingly, there are two manufacturers of products that are no longer stocked in Waitrose that used to be. So Carmel was a manufacturer based in Israel that Waitrose used to stock. I did a Google on it. And when you look at the online shop, it says this product is no longer stocked. So I think if people are going to be really careful about this, they need to look at own labels, because I think what may be happening, as with medjool dates, is that rather stocking the stuff from the producer that's named an Israeli producer, they're producing them under their own names with Israel as a source of origin of the product.
Esther Giles there talking about her specific efforts to get Waitrose to actually even pay attention to the fact that the, even though they're supposed to have an ethical policy, that there is a genocide going on over in Israel. Do you think there's going to be any sort of campaign comparable to the South African boycotts in the 1980s, Martin?
I think that's definitely on the cards, and the Israelis definitely fear it. And that's why they're trying to push this idea that anybody who calls for a boycott of Israel is therefore ipso facto an anti-Semite, which is frankly absurd and insulting.
Also, there's a report on a website I'd not come across before, but it's called Amity Underground. Motion to the British Parliament to condemn the slaughter of Palestinian civilians receives fewer signatures than the motion to cherish British hedgehogs in the same week. Early day motion to condemn the slaughter of 63 Palestinian civilians at the hands of the British equipped Israeli Defence Force received only 28 signatures in the House of Commons, three fewer than a motion to cherish hedgehogs. By regulating various traps taken 2 days before. Not a single member of the incumbent Conservative Party signed the motion. Only 18 of 257 Labour parliamentarians signed it, though Eastgate Easington MP Graham Morris sponsored the bill. The Green Party's only MP, Caroline Lucas, signed it, with the rest of the signatures representing Scottish National Party, Plaid Cymru and Liberal Democrat reps. I mean, this is doesn't show a great deal of interest by... it's almost like the British MPs aren't really interested in what's going on in
Gaza. Well, I think it's quite significant that no Conservatives signed it, but I think it's quite shocking that only 18 Labour MPs signed it, and I would suggest that Thangam Debonair, who's a very solid majority in Bristol West, where she is now, and actually went to the anti-Semitism protest against Jeremy Corbyn, she might think it's in her own interest to sign such a motion, even if it doesn't come to be voted on, because when the next election comes, she's going to be facing the Greens in this constituency, and it'll be one of the Greens' top targets. And one of the things they're going to say is, why didn't you sign that motion?
There is also, I mean, we'll be discussing it further next week on Dialect at noon on Tuesday here on BCFM, but there is actually a discussion for anyone that's interested in this topic from all directions about anti-Semitism and Islamophobia at the Ark Bar in Broad Street at 7 o'clock on Monday the 25th of June. Speakers are from Palestinian human rights lawyer. There's Jewish Voice for Labour there, one anti-racist activist, Palestine Solidarity Campaign, Stop the War Coalition and the National Union of Teachers, Martin, all getting together to discuss this.
Yeah, and it's been sponsored by a variety of different organisations. I spoke to somebody about this earlier in the week, and it looks like it's going to be quite a lively discussion. I'm very glad to see that Jewish Voices for Labour are going to be there. We need to hear the voice of progressive Jewry. We're not anti-Semites. We know that that there's plenty of Jews out there who think like we do. They don't like people being oppressed. And one of the, you know, one of the Jewish socialist groups' slogans is, always on the side of the oppressed. Always.
The English Defence League founder Tommy Robinson had a big demonstration the other week in London, Martin, about this. But the thing is...
Not about this.
About Tommy Robinson being arrested. Yeah. But the topic of Islamophobia came up in a lot of speeches there. Why is it that the rights... groups like the EDL are so, it seems, affiliated with the Zionists now? You actually see Zionist flags at quite a lot of these right-wing events.
Well, that's what's been happening, is that the right wing everywhere have some shared interests. And you feel like saying to Tommy, do you remember when the Israelis used to kill British soldiers? Do you remember, Tommy? The King David Hotel. Wasn't mostly British soldiers, mostly Arab civilians working for the British government.
What do you make?
Are you a terrorist, Tommy?
What do you make of the arrest then and the imprisonment of Tommy Robinson?
Well, I've followed it to some extent. I mean, basically, he was arrested for contempt of court because it's a trial in Leeds, which is trying to send some people down for grooming young girls. Many of these people on trial are Muslims. Or they're not practicing Muslims, I don't suppose, but they are of Muslim origin. And he's then latched onto this, as a, you know, isn't this terrible, these Muslims doing all this stuff. Now, in actual fact, the police have arrested them and put them on trial. And what Tommy's doing by turning up and shooting his mouth of outside the court, he's leading to a situation where the trial might collapse because the defence lawyers are going to argue we're not getting a fair trial here because Tommy Robinson's sticking his finger in. So the judge then says to Tommy Robinson, you've got to stop doing this. Tommy pleaded guilty. He's not called Tommy, actually. He's called something else. Yaxley Lennon. And, of course, he doesn't use that name because he used to be a BNP activist, British National Party activist. He wants to pretend to be something other than he is. And, of course, the court said, we don't want you sticking your finger in here because we're trying to send these people down. And it's quite possible, by you shooting your mouth off, that they might get off. And, of course, that's why he's been sent to prison. Because he's been making a nuisance of himself. And, of course, I also think that he's possibly... both the English Defence League and Al-Majah Haroon were born at exactly the same moment in Luton. And that's where he's from. And I believe that, personally, that Al-Majah Haroon and the English Defence League are heavily infiltrated by MI5. They're basically Gladio-style organisations, both of them.
What do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean by that is that there's a strategy of tension being run in this country. Jihadis are basically, like the Islamic Fighting Group based in Manchester. They're based in Manchester because MI6 invited them to Manchester in the 1980s.
I noticed, by the way, a lot of activity on social media really promoting Tommy Robinson and promoting the idea that he's been unjustly put in jail. And it's really an issue of freedom of speech, but it's not, is it?
No, it's not. It's contempt of court. He's running the risk. I mean, Geert Wilders came to speak at this rally last Saturday. And he got support from the French National Front. If you look at photographs, you'll see various people marching around giving Nazi salutes. And these people are Nazis by any definition.
Okay, so there's a piece in the Guardian.
What do we do with Nazis?
There's a piece in the Guardian.
Talk to them, shoot them.
Piece in the Guardian yesterday. This by Claude Moraes. The far right is organised and growing. Those Nazi salutes are serious, he says. Tommy Robinson's supporters are drawing strength from racist movements in Europe and the persistent popularity of Donald Trump. About 15,000 supporters of Tommy Robinson, the former leader of the English Defence League, marched in London last week. Some were aggressive, attacked the police, and physically threatened anti-racists who were peacefully protesting against them. Among their number were people raising their arms in Nazi salutes. This is a serious situation that demands attention from everyone who wants to combat the racist politics that have regrettably emerged from so many parts of Europe. Now, exactly the same happened, Martin, didn't it, in the 1930s, in the rise of Nazi Germany, largely because of poverty. This was looking at someone down the road or nearby, also poor, probably, to blame for the economic woes. So when a country is in a difficult economic situation, it's actually fertile ground for this kind of thing.
Yeah, well, okay, well, let's just... what I'm also saying is there is a strategy of tension happening in Britain. And the original strategy of tension in Italy, the intelligence services were running far-left, far-right organisations. They were running both sides of the park. And I think that's exactly what's going on here. The English Defence League and Al-Majah Haroon, supposedly chalk and cheese, they both emerged in Luton simultaneously. The Royal Anglian Regiment marched through Luton, having come back from Afghanistan, and Al-Majah Haroon protested against the Royal Anglian Regiment, and then the English Defence League came to the defence of the Royal Anglian Regiment and its business in Afghanistan. And, of course, we've got no business being in Afghanistan, and, of course, this whole thing is on the back of 9/11 and all the rest of it. But I believe that all of these groups, the jihadi groups that were told to fear, and the English Defence League, are heavily infiltrated by the intelligence services.
But, I mean, is this sort of modern equivalent of the Oswald Mosley black shirts?
Yes, it is, but the intelligence services were active in that era, but not as active as they are now. Don't forget that the whole Islamist jihadi setup was part of Operation Cyclone, in which Britain was the lead agency in the 1980s, and that's where we brought all these jihadis to Britain. So that's where they came from, Tommy.
And
MI6.
The idea that these are going to be kind of street fighters in the future, a bit like the SA in Nazi Germany?
Well, I think some of their lads...
Ernst Röhm comes to mind?
I think some of their lads imagine that they might be, but I think that if you look at what happened in Northern Ireland, you can march like that, but actually fighting is a bit of a different thing, and they're not really... They can make an awful lot of trouble. But win a civil war when they haven't got a single elected councillor in Britain anywhere... I don't think so.
Claude Moraes says he fully supports the Together Against Trump demonstration, coinciding with his visit on the 13th of July, and also the Stand Up to Racism's call for a peaceful protest on the 14th of July against another pro-Robinson demo. Everyone who cares about the future of our society should come together for the politics of unity, not division, he says.
Well, that week is shaping up because on the Thursday, the 12th, there's going to be an anti-Trump protest in Bristol, which will assemble at the fountains at 5 p.m. There's then going to be a coach to London the following morning for those who've got time to go on a Friday to protest against Trump. And clearly also, Tommy Robinson and his chums have got to realise if you demonstrate, we're going to demonstrate against you. That's what we did with the National Front in the 1980s, and that's what we'll do again. And we'll beat them.
Do you see this kind of thing actually having waves with more civil unrest?
Well, I mean, the fact of the matter is, we were discussing earlier the potential collapse of the economy and so on, and in those circumstances, the possibility of far right coming to power, as they've done in the Ukraine and as they may do in other European countries, it's definitely there. And of course, the real danger is that the US is lurching down in this this direction, and they've got the biggest military on the planet. But ultimately, if we're going to have sovereignty, Tommy, it means looking at where the jihadis came from, and they came from MI6, as anybody will tell you who knows anything about it. And I believe that both EDL and Al-Majah Haroon, the Captain Hook and all the rest of it, MI5 agent Tommy, MI5. And Tommy's had lots of chats with MI5, I'm sure. And he's being set up to be a martyr to gather all these people together. And then the police will turn around to the liberal centre like us and say, oh, well, we've got to have more powers to deal with people like Tommy. And we'll go, oh, yes, great. And then they turn around to others and say, we're going to have more powers to deal with the Muslims. Oh, great. But in actual fact, the whole thing is being orchestrated by the intelligence services. It's a strategy of tension, Gladio-style strategy of tension. They've been doing it for years. They're still doing it. It's not, everything is not what it seems.
BCFM. Well, as I said at the top of the hour, we're going to have a look now to the Bilderberg conference last week. Noticed over in Turin, this is the NATO zone's most powerful business lobby. It's been going ever since 1954. It meets once a year. It was chaired for the first 20 years by a former SS officer, Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, who also betrayed the British troops at Arnhem by sending in a so-called agent that betrayed the entire plan to the Abwehr. So there's a sort of in a nutshell what Bilderberg is, but last week we got in slightly rudely interrupted, Martin, by the Italian police, didn't we, because our journalists were being detained as all their identities were checked, even though they knew exactly who they were.
Well, that's right, and it'll be interesting to hear what others have got to say about what happened at Bilderberg last week, which wasn't hardly reported, apart from in the alternative press, wasn't it?
Well, there is a documentary that they've made, which they mention here, which is very well worth a watch, which has got English subtitles. We'll hear now from the We Are Change Rotterdam crew that were over there filming. That's Maria van Maria van Boelkelen and Marco Verhage, mostly Maria, because she's the one who's really interested in this whole high-tech stuff that the Bilderberg are talking about and the 5G.
From my point of view, that is everything that involves AI, 5G, or the development of the smart control grids that we're facing. So they talked about the future of work, which definitely will go on about AI. There was a big research paper done by KPMG, and it was all about the effects of AI on the workforce, and that is stunning, you know, that is big, that is major. So they have to talk about the future of work, obviously.
How do we know if we're talking to a real person or a computer nowadays?
You can't, unfortunately. It will be very difficult to make sure that, on the other hand, like right now, there is a real person. And I think they did, from their perspective, a splendid job. They did the Turing test, and they took it to several chatbots. And it was believable, difficult, so hardly impossible to make sure that the person which is talking to you, to make sure that it's a human person.
Good God. I mean, so what you're saying is somebody who you're talking to in either an internet chat room or maybe on Twitter could just be artificial intelligence computer.
Exactly. Exactly. It's something that I love to hate, or I hate to love, but still, you can also see there is a new technology. You can talk in your head. I'm not kidding you around. Silently talk in your head, and then we are connected with another person that has this specific tool put it on his head. It's now still quite big, but that's only a matter of time. So we're entering an age that we don't know exactly if the person that we're talking to is really a person. And that's possible to have a sort of telepathy between persons, so you don't know if people are speaking with them when you are sitting with them in the room. So you could imagine what that would mean in terms of justice, people that get picked up by the police, etc. So we're really entering a sort of twilight zone.
I mean, it sounds to me like science fiction, this. And the other problem with that kind of telepathy system is what happens when you're able to read someone else's thoughts and they don't know.
Exactly. So they're a little bit hush-hush about this kind of possibilities, because they now only are looking at a way that people give their consent. But on the other hand, you know, this thing is, these developments are going incredible fast. And so what we see that is public is probably out of the pilot phase and pushed in regular usage. So that's one thing that you have to keep in mind. So that's all about artificial intelligence. Then you have, in the same league, you have this quantum computing. Well, quantum computing is a term that I don't think that most Bilderbergers knows a lot about. It's quite difficult to understand. So I'm really in doubt why as well artificial intelligence as quantum computing is on the list. But I have to admit, when you see the lineup, we see Jared Cohen over there, we see Alex Karp, we see Hasabis. These are all people from very powerful companies like DeepMind, like Google. What's the last?
Palantir?
Yeah, Palantir, thank you.
Yeah, so this, let's have a little chat about these technologies, though, because I've been having a look at Palantir and their various systems. One of them is called Gotham, which I imagine is modelled on Gotham City in Batman. And the idea is that they're trying to sell this technology to our politicians, to our civil servants, and saying, well, using this technology, you can completely understand and look into and drill down into your entire population. So, for example, if you wanted to know where the Muslims are in your country, if you wanted to know where the rich people are, if you wanted to know where the people who use bicycles are, if you wanted to know where the people who shop at a particular supermarket are in your country, you can have a map using this Palantir technology of everybody and where they are, and you can understand. I mean, this is what they're doing, is they're selling this to our politicians, saying, here's the best way to understand who your voters and your population are.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And I think with the rollout of 5G that is going quite smooth and swiftly in Europe, they have set up a sort of control grid, because 5G, probably you know this, needs a very tight network. You know, the frequency makes it possible to have real-time data exchange. And that's not only about pictures, so it's not only about facial recognition, but it's also about sounds. So you can do anything with this. So it's not only about receiving the information, it's also about sending information or frequencies.
Well, that's an interesting way of putting it, because we think of these, I mean, we've got a lot of government money behind smart meters here in Britain.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, they're pushing these things into our houses, even though the people don't want them. The idea is that you can have a smart meter, which you can access. The fact of the matter is, though, that also the electricity, the gas companies, they can access these things and they can switch it off. The other thing is that if it's hacked, somebody from China, America, the NSA, GCHQ, whoever can hack in and switch off your power. So these things are a bit of a cursed technology. They call it the Internet of Things. What do you make of this smart technology?
Oh, yeah. Well, we made a documentary about the subject. It's called Digitropolis. Digitropolis, it's an hour-long documentary about health, about the effects on your daily routine, about how is power developed, and it's not in Dutch. It's subtitles in English, in German.
Oh, subtitles, fantastic.
Spanish. So, but the most important thing about this is that, and that is something I want to underline, is that we don't think about what is happening right now under our nose. So, for an example, for the smart meters, you have this activist group called Empower. I think people need to check this out because they are doing a very great job. But the other thing is that all these little 5G boxes that we'll put on our Latin poles, they will actually have the possibility to create a sort of active denial system. The same system that is used in Iraq by defense. So you can imagine if they can.
Hang on,
turn.
This is the lampposts, and you've got boxes on top of the lampposts. And if they're configured in a certain way, it will emit such a concentration of microwaves that it actually starts to burn your skin and you have to run away.
Exactly. I'm not saying that they will do that, but that they will be able to do this. And I think that's scary enough.
Maria, what about your favorite participant?
Well, my favorite participant is definitely Jared Cohen. this guy is really amazing. He's now the head of Jigsaw. And Jigsaw is a part of Google before it was well known as Google Ideas. And this guy is really something different. I think he was 24 years old. He already worked with Condoleezza Rice. Then he worked with Hillary Clinton. He was well known as the person who was twittering when Iran burned. And then he was a special advisor of Richard Holbrooke. And he wrote a bestseller book with Eric Schmidt from Google. And he really introduced Jared Cohen as a sort of, well, how you could say it, our new savior. So this guy is very well known in politics on a very high level. And he is very smart and now head of one of the most powerful tech companies in the world. So, well, that gives you quite an idea why this guy is so incredibly important for now and I think for the next couple of 10 years.
You've got the dreams of the super rich. These are the sorts of people who, you know, their money, they've bought everything they possibly can with the money they've got, the billions of dollars that they're, you know, in control of. They can buy, you know, multiple houses. They can buy themselves their own private jet. They can buy a nice luxury yacht, whatever it is. But once they've got all those things,
they want more. They want more, Tony. Don't you understand? They always want more.
It's never enough.
No.
And that's why I bring up transhumanism, because there are some people out there, I mean, whether they're right or wrong, I have no idea, but they're selling this idea that you can actually go beyond being a human. That is to say...
And they are doing it right now.
What they're saying is, I mean, I think it's Ray Kurzweil, who's the head of engineering at Google, because Google feature very big at this year's Bilderberg. When somebody asked him, they said, do you think God exists? Ray Kurzweil says, well, no, but he will soon.
Oh, yeah. But Ray Kurzweil is a very special person. He's also one of the major figures in our documentary because he's a visionary, you know. I think he's in this business for ages, I think over 30 years. And he has this very strong idea that he wants to make a step up, a new evolution, the humanoids 2.0, as he calls it. And it's not about digital revolution. It's all about a human evolution. And Ray Kurzweil want to be the person that supports this, that makes this possible.
But is this a utopia or is it a dystopia?
No, it's not a utopia. And I think Ray Kurzweil mentioned that 2028 will be the moment that we will be humanoids. And he makes a very strong case about this. And I think it's feasible. And if you look at other related designs like Neuralace and Neuralink that is now more or less owned by Elon Musk, you have to admit it will be quite simple, a matter of time before we will be able to have our personal experience, like you're looking at a movie right now, or you can learn a language in, well, an hour or two. So it's really entering the matrix in a way that we never thought of. We always thought of a fear for chips or something in our body. That's not really the point anymore. We went way beyond this whole concept. And we're looking to a new evolution. That's one of the major topics, I think, that we as journalists are now trying to understand and trying
But Maria, surely, I mean, I'm sure if Ray was here, he'd say, look, this could be a wonderful utopia.
Oh, yeah. Of course, I think, and I have to admit, a lot of developments that comes from and inventions that comes from AI are marvelous, and I love them all. So it's not about what they develop, it's how you use this technique. And I think there is no ethical restrictions, no law, no common sense about that. We really need to think about what can happen in the worst case scenario. But everyone is driven by money. Everyone wants to get a piece of the pie, and they want to be the first one, because there's a lot at stake right now. So yeah, we are looking at a very interesting time, and I think it will all kick off by the implementing of 5G, because that is the infrastructure that AI needs to really develop more quicker than it does right now.
The singularity which these transhumanists talk about is this whole idea that the computer will actually become conscious. And
yeah.
Do you think that's real? That sounds like, you know, that 2001, The Space Odyssey.
It will definitely happen. Like Elon Musk say, artificial intelligence will develop itself super speed. And what will happen is that we will not understand. We are not able to understand the output of AI. That's a huge problem. You have to compare us to an AI as a sort of pet, like Elon Musk said. We're a sort of nice cat comparing to what AI will be. So if you don't restrict it, if you don't use it in the correct way, if you don't make sure that all the check and balances are okay, we will look at a very dystopian future. And it's not in 100 or 200 years. It's probably between 50 and 80 years.
Also, genetic engineering is a big part of this. They're saying that they believe that they might be able to genetically engineer humans so that they will, their children anyway, will live forever.
And they're already doing it. If you know the Chinese company BGI, you have to really check that these guys are amazing. They've done a lot of work with CRISPR-Cas9, that is part of your DNA that seems to be really easy to modify. But in China, you already can make sure that your children have a nice eye color, or they don't suffer from depression, if that's the point in your family background. So we all are already entering this zone. And
okay, how much do I have to pay in order for my children to live forever then?
Yeah, that's a good thing. How much do you have to pay? I don't have a clue, but I'm sure it will be a figure.
Probably the figure that only the Bilderbergers can afford it.
Yeah, and especially the Chinese very rich, or the Saudis, or people that have loads of money and power. But I don't think it's only about money. It's also about exchanging powers and exchanging network opportunities.
Yeah. So I wonder what our former Home Secretary Amber Rudd made of all that last weekend at the Bilderberg conference. That was Maria Birkelen, and a brief little bit with Marco Verhage from We Are Change Rotterdam, who actually got, if you go onto their YouTube channel, I'll put a link up to it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. You get a lot of the shots of the people actually arriving. They got absolutely brilliant position to shoot from, which nobody else seemed to get. Anyway, time to sign off for the Murdoch News at 8 now. Thanks to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and Fee Hance, who's Green Councillor for Redland earlier. Dialects on next Tuesday at noon. You'll find this show's podcast, story, links, and comment page, and our contact details at thisweek.org.uk. And I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for the politics show at 6 o'clock next week. God bless. Don't let the banksters get you down.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, in studio with our co-host, Chase Palmieri. On today's program, we are rejoined by world-renowned educator, author, and public intellectual, Professor Henry Giroux. We'll discuss his latest book from City Lights Books' Open Media Series on today's program. The title, American Nightmare, Facing the Challenge of Fascism. Stay with us.
Crimes perpetrated by criminal minds, political ties, habitual eyes, alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, the apocalypse, got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison, genocide, wars, fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by taxes, while the prisons and the levees and the mines collapsing, all the prisons, filled with capacity citizens, and the times for the master thief, divine conquer, steal the masterpiece, open your eyes and realize what's happening, times running out the reach, all potential fame at the table, then you're probably on the main.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we are delighted to have back with us Henry A. Giroux. Henry Giroux is a world-renowned educator, author, and public intellectual. He currently holds the professorship for scholarship in the public interest and the Paulo Freire Distinguished Scholar Chair in Critical Pedagogy at McMaster University. His most recent books include The Violence of Organized Forgetting, that's a City Lights book from 2014. Neoliberalism's War on Higher Education, Haymarket, also 2014. Disposable Futures, that's a City Lights book from 2015. Again, you'll notice Henry Giroux is quite a prolific author. And today on the program, we are bringing him back to talk about his brand new release on City Lights Books Open Media Series, American Nightmare, Facing the Challenge of Fascism. Henry Giroux, welcome back to the Project Censored Show.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be back, Mickey, always.
It always is great to talk to you, Henry Giroux, and you're very generous with your time, so we're glad that we'll have you on today for the hour. And let's start by talking about your brand new book that's just out this week on City Lights Books. And, you know, you've written about this topic for some time, but this is a few hundred page tour de force, American Nightmare, Facing the Challenge of Fascism, with a foreword by George Yancey. So, Henry Giroux, let's just start from the beginning. The introduction with George Yancey sets the stage for your book really well. Can you talk a little bit about what Yancey introduces for us here and how you selected him?
Well, I think that one of the things that I wanted to make clear in this book is there's an element of what I call neoliberal fascism at work here that is often not talked about when people increasingly talk about the rise of fascism in the United States, and that's white supremacy and what I call racial purity, the logic of racial purity, the discourse of racial purity, and the politics of disposability. I mean, I think that all of these are being accelerated in such a way that you have a kind of capitalism on steroids, not just around questions of the acceleration of profits and the dispossession of people and so forth and so on. It's not just about economic structures, but it's a racial war that's at work that is something that often is underplayed, if not overlooked. And I thought George, particularly given his own absolutely excellent and profound work on questions of race and white supremacy, was a perfect person to sort of introduce this book. There's also something else about George. I mean, I think that there aren't a lot of theorists around who have what I call a comprehensive understanding of politics. A lot of people are sort of stuck in silos, in single-issue movements, which is not to deride those movements, but it seems to me that in many ways you have to put these movements in a much larger context in order to understand both their strengths and their limitations, and also the need for these various movements to come together and to be able to speak to each other in terms of a larger project, the project that I would call the promises and the ideals of a radical democracy.
Indeed. And Yancey, also a professor of philosophy at Emory University, historian Carol Anderson also at Emory, and does great work on race and history. So this is sort of the genesis or the crux of what you're getting at here in American Nightmare. And I know both Yancey and you love the quote James Baldwin and really get a sense of urgency, I think, both historically and in context and up to the present. So you start right at the beginning. And again, you don't pull punches here. You start staring into the authoritarian abyss. So in your definition, and again, this is not just about Donald Trump, obviously. This is a 40, 50 plus year slide, neoliberal fascist slide into the situations that we're in, and you go into that in the book. But tell us about how you start out your new book.
What I tried to do initially was to make clear the scope of this disaster. We're not just talking about a guy who is baiting immigrants and so forth and so on. We're talking about a guy who's actually and who has changed the language of fascism, American fascism, in a way that it's totally unapologetic. I mean, this guy takes pride in basically attacking people and attacking people of color and attacking poor people. But I think that what I wanted to make clear was that, you know, if we're really going to talk about fascism, you know, in its emerging forms in the United States, we've really got to talk about education. We've got to talk about the fact that this rationality permeates, economizes, and drives a language that takes humanity out of the discourse. It has nothing to say about questions of justice. It has nothing to say about questions of ethics, empathy, compassion. I mean, it's a language that increasingly has expelled democracy from its vocabulary. And I think that's an enormously important thing to understand, because what I'm trying to do in the book is to make clear that neoliberal fascism tells a story. And that story is a story that's undermined and displaced some of the most important principles that make the institutions and the language of democracy possible. I mean, it talks about freedom as the freedom from government, freedom from the interference by others, the freedom to say anything you want, even though it may be racist and it might be derogatory and humiliating. But it also, in a sense, does something dreadful. And I try consistently throughout the book to make this very clear. It individualizes social problems. It basically undercuts the possibility for agency by suggesting that the problems that we face alone, and that we alone are responsible for them. And I think that's one of the most powerful elements of public pedagogy that neoliberal fascism seizes onto. It makes people powerless because they can't translate individual and private problems into larger systemic issues. And I think that develops and produces a sense of enormous powerlessness, enormous rage, enormous anxiety. Couple that with the economic structure, the economic conditions in which people are in a world of, in which they're just basically trying to survive and live in a world of utter uncertainty and precarity. And that's a very lethal combination. And I think that works in many ways throughout the book.
Henry Giroux, you start the book by talking, you literally have the definition of fascism here. I suppose it's still not something in vogue in terms of analysis in the United States. Fascism is one of those terms that sort of comes kicking and screaming through history, and it's attached to the Nazis. It's attached to that earlier era in Spain. It's attached to Mussolini in Italy. The definition, an authoritarian, nationalistic, right-wing system of government and social organization, the general use, you say, extreme right-wing, authoritarian, or intolerant views or practice. Let's go in and talk about, I mean, we're in Trump's America, make America great again, right? That's some pretty significantly coded language. Let's go back historically, and maybe you can walk us through some of this. What is the thread, historically, of fascist ideology, and how do we see it manifest today?
I think that we see it in a whole range of assumptions. At least we saw it in the past. Those assumptions in many ways are quite clear. A sort of appeal to an ultra-nationalism, disdain for human rights, the identification of enemies as a unifying cause, the supremacy of the military, a kind of rampant sexism, control of the media, the notion that America is in a constant state of crisis, a contempt for weakness and dissent, a sort of acceleration of the dark side of hypermasculinity. All of these are kind of endemic to a generic, I would think in some ways, to a generic fascism, contempt for the rule of law, of course. But I think that one of the things that we have to recognize is that when we often talk about fascism historically, it's sort of seen as something that's stuck in history. You know, it's like a static form that doesn't repeat itself, and that it's basically something that's described as part of a long-lost historical memory, while still frightening, no longer taken too seriously because it's confined to the past. And I think that when you look at people like Hannah Arendt, Timothy Snyder, I mean, a whole range of historians who have been studying this stuff, Robert Paxton, for years. I mean, what they all say is relatively similar, and they say that fascism basically can crystallize into new forms. And I think that what I've tried to do with the book is to talk about how those basic elements of fascism get reworked into today the logic of disposability, America first, a different kind of ultranationalism, the claim that America is in decline, the acceptance of the fact that the political state has become the corporate state, and that's very important, the recognition that cultural sovereignty is all these states have left, meaning that they're defining themselves in terms of a cultural logic and not an economic logic because they no longer have control over their resources, and that the state now simply mobilizes itself in order to make sure that this global elite gets everything they want in terms of financial resources. I think that another thing that we see with respect to this, what I call the mobilizing passions of neoliberal fascism as both a project and as a movement today, is that not only does it produce massive amounts of inequality and suffering and dismantle government agencies and services, but it focuses in such a way, it does this in such a way as to mobilize what I call the passions of fascism. They're not, it's actually not my term. It's Paxton's term.
Mm-hmm. Friendly fascism, actually, what Paxton wrote about, correct?
Yeah, what he wrote about.
Right.
He uses that term, the passions, the mobilizing passions of fascism. And I think that we see that now in an economic system, a neoliberal economic system that's on steroids. I mean, remember, in the past, even when these elements of authoritarianism emerged, you saw a couple of things. You still saw a slight respect for the social contract. You still saw a slight respect for social provisions. You still saw a language that, as cruel as it wasn't arrogant about defining that language so as to wear it like a badge. The racism was somewhat clouded in the discourses of colorblindness and all that nonsense. Now, my God, you've got a language of cruelty, a culture of cruelty. You've got the common good being destroyed or spoken of with utter disdain. You see public spheres being dismantled. You see people running the basic agencies of government in ways to absolutely destroy those agencies if they have anything whatsoever to do with the common good. It's a very different kind of fascism in many ways, driven by an extreme form of capitalism that we haven't seen in the past.
Well, Henry Giroux, it's also the case that this seems to be championed by both leading Democrats and Republicans in Washington, D.C., and across the states. Let's not forget about state politics, where there's an overwhelming number of very right-leaning governors, and we've seen recent Supreme Court rulings.
I'm not suggesting at all that this is simply something that's in the federal government. What I'm suggesting is this project and movement actually encompasses all levels of government, it seems to me, in the United States. And you're right. It's not just about Republicans. That's nonsense. What we really have to ask ourselves is what political parties were at work in different ways and in different degrees in creating the economic and financial conditions that made this massive inequality and this logic of disposability possible. And they both did. Only the Republicans were worse.
Indeed. And we see, though, that the recent Supreme Court rulings seem to champion discrimination, uphold voter suppression. And again, looking at some of these historic hallmarks of fascism, and this is not just the Trump administration, but certainly since Trump has taken office, we've seen profound expressions against immigrants, against women. The administration practically drips with misogyny. The mask has been taken off. Like the neoliberal approaches that have been coming at us for decades, right, under the Obama administration, and certainly you were very critical of the Obama administration. We have it Project Censored. But with the Trump administration, it's as if the mask has come off, and now you're using this term neoliberal fascism.
Yeah, absolutely. You're absolutely right. The mask has come off, and I think we need to recognize, I mean, we need to recognize two things here. We need to recognize that neoliberalism in many ways has accentuated its own logic of austerity to such a point that the degree of suffering that it's causing at every level, the degree of powerlessness, coupled with an ideology that offers the wrong solutions and misdirects the rage so as to actually reinforce its own essential conditions of power. That's what's so powerful about this. So I'm not saying that neoliberalism is fascism. I'm saying that neoliberalism creates the grounds for a kind of fascism in which it's difficult to separate one from the other.
Well, you know, you have a great you have several great epigraphs. One of the epigraphs you have in the book is Michel Foucault, a great quote that says, "The strategic adversary is fascism, the fascism in us all, in our heads and in our everyday behavior, the fascism that causes us to love power, to desire the very thing that dominates and exploits us."
Yeah, yeah.
So can you connect some of that to what you just said?
What I'm trying to say here is that when we talk about, and the left is terrible on this. I mean, the left often talks about fascism in terms of economic conditions, right, and structures. And I think that when you go back to the Frankfurt School, and you go back to people like Adorno and, of course, Horkheimer and Eric Fromm, and, of course, Wilhelm Reich, what they're saying is be careful. What they're saying is that fascism is internalized. It operates at the level of desire, at the level of psychology, at the level of consciousness, at the level of unconsciousness, so as to create needs and desires and values that basically tie people to forms of oppression that they come to support, but actually ends up oppressing them. And we see this all the time now in the United States, as we all know. People saying, well, yeah, get the government off our backs, but, you know, which means they'll take away their Social Security, take away Medicaid, Medicare, and all the kinds of things that actually keep them practically alive. But I think that what we are really getting at here, and I think I'm correct on this, is that we're talking about education becoming central to politics. Vaclav Havel had a term that sometimes is difficult to interpret, but he said, politics follows culture. And what he meant by that is probably in some way unclear but needs to be said, is that consciousness gives rise to politics, certainly in its best and most resisting form, but also in a way that basically allows people to invest themselves in forms of consciousness and in particular modes of ideology that are utterly destructive and utterly at odds with their own sense of possibility and at odds with their own freedom. And I think that we need to be very clear about why education is so central to politics, that we have two elements of fascism at work as a project and a movement, it seems to me. You have an economic structure, causes massive inequality, distributes wealth upwards. We know all about that, right? You know, eradicates cities, eliminates all kinds of social provisions. And then you have a kind of soft fascism, right? A fascism that operates at the level of needs and desires, which is basically expanded through the cultural apparatuses that have now become the great right-wing teaching machines of the 21st century, whether we're talking about the Pravda version of Fox News, Breitbart, Sinclair Broadcasting, or whatever.
Well, I misspoke earlier. You were talking about Bob Paxton, and I was thinking of Gross's book, The Friendly Fascism, The New Face of Power, which goes back decades. And you've been writing about this for a long time. But, you know, so have select others here in the U.S. And it's kind of bewildering, a couple bewildering points here that you've brought up. One is it's pretty amazing how you hear from certain demographics in the population, people saying, get government off my back. But then without certain things the government does, those people would be the very victims of the changes in those policies.
Oh, absolutely.
But the other is, on the other end of the spectrum, in the punditocracy and among educational elites, there's a great aversion to using the F word, right? Fascism.
Oh, no, they're starting to use it now.
It's very recent. And again, I think that one of the unfortunate elements of that is because in the liberal end of the spectrum, it seems that it's because of Trump. And if we could only just take care of Donald Trump, everything would go back to normal. Well, normal wasn't okay.
That's absolutely right. This could have stayed more of a Democratic Party, at least the center-right, right, version. I mean, they're now defining themselves as the party of resistance. And the only way that they can do that is to actually mimic Trump by engaging in the politics of diversion.
Well, this is, again, this is how it's all being, in my view, being driven into the ditch. It's just one distraction after another. It's
right.
Governing by tweet. And the corporate press is just kind of hook, line, and sinker, really cheer-led the way from the campaign all the way through now. And the Democrats, I like to call them the Mick resistance with a little trademark sign, right? This is not Democratic engagement. This is not civic engagement, small d Democratic engagement. And again, this is really the politics of division and fear. I'd like to remind listeners that we are speaking with Professor Henry Giroux. You're tuned to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff. After this brief musical break, we're going to continue our conversation with Professor Henry Giroux about his recent book. It's out just this week from City Lights Open Media Series. It's called American Nightmare, Facing the Challenge of Fascism. Stay with us.
See, I gotta draw a line, I can't take it no more. If you ain't down with revolution, what you waiting for? Making money for suckers, so not communities poor. Ripping flags off of coffins, man, this ain't our war. Colonized and terrorized by the world's biggest killers. The U.S. government, the biggest weapon and drug dealers. Filling prisons with children, incarcerating the future.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we're speaking with Professor Henry A. Giroux. He's a world-renowned educator, prolific author, over 60 books, and public intellectual. He's at McMaster University up in Canada. Henry Giroux, we mentioned earlier education, the role education plays. So I wanted to revisit that, not only through the privatization of education, but through the deconstruction of the public sphere and the attack on public education. I think that's really been a Trojan horse for a lot of these myopic, market-driven agendas. And so how do you see that as sort of getting us to the crisis we're at?
I think that one of the things that we've seen increasingly over the last 40 years is not just that education basically is being undermined in terms of being discarded as failing. They claim it's failing because it's public. That's why they claim it's failing. But I think that you're right. When you look at the lack of funding, the defunding of public education, when you look at the move towards charter schools, the privatization, when you look at the attempt in many ways to increase the segregation that goes on in schools by rewarding some schools and, of course, those that are basically black and brown and poor with no funds whatsoever, by punishing teachers and going after public servants, by claiming that unions are basically on the side of injustice and do nothing to promote the rights of children. I mean, this is a full-fledged attack on the very concept of the public and on the concept of the public good. And schools are particularly dangerous for these people because they realize that at some level, it's conceivable that those schools hold the promise of actually educating people to think. I mean, the attack on public education amongst all of its various registers is really an attack on the radical imagination. It's really an attack on the ability of an institution to say that we need to educate people not only to be morally responsible, but to be critical citizens. And I think that schools are seen as enormously dangerous, just as the oppositional media, as another form of education, is seen as enormously dangerous. But I think that the endless neoliberal attack by these billionaires, by these conservative institutions, by the think tanks, it's a war on public education, higher education, and it's a war on youth. And it's a war on teachers, and it's a war on students.
This is Chase Palmieri. Henry, one quick question for you. You talked about how education, higher education, is the solution here, and you just mentioned again how billionaires are influencing the universities, turning them more into training grounds. Can you talk about practical ways, as you mentioned in your recent profile on Truthdig, about how billionaires like the Koch brothers are actually going about attacking these institutions?
What they're doing is, it's really quite remarkable. I mean, they're doing a number of things. First of all, they're putting enormous amounts of money into educating people to go into the schools, these ideologues, whether they be students or whether they be faculty, and actually begin to mobilize all kinds of right-wing clubs, newspapers, all the kinds of things that would basically be seen as part of an extracurricular set of activities to do everything they can to push the alt-right and the neoliberal ideologies that they support. Secondly, they're giving enormous amounts of money to schools and asking them to set up institutes in their names. In some cases, they're giving money to these universities, and they're actually on the boards that choose faculty, which is stunning, hard to believe. You look at places like George Mason University, and it's like the Koch University. I mean, the Koch Brothers University. They have given so much money to that school that they're beginning to exercise enormous influence, not only over who might get hired, but what priorities are given to what knowledge formations, what fields become crucial. They're pushing free market economics. They're saying, look, we'll give you millions. Put together a free market set of courses, if not a school. And we'll support this. And, of course, schools being underfunded, particularly in public education, many of them losing as much as 50% of their funding over the last 30 years, in many cases are more than willing to do that. And you know what the implications of that might be. Thirdly, you see a lot of people in higher education are actually affiliated with the corporations and the boards that the Koch brothers push. So they go on, they become part of the advisory groups. And all of a sudden, there's an enormous conflict of interest. They're getting like $200,000 a year to be on these boards, and they're then setting policy and sitting in on decisions as to who gets tenure. Now, couple that again with a fourth movement that's pushed by the billionaires, and that is they're increasingly talking to and doing everything they can to talk to trustees to sort of do away with tenure, do away with long-term faculty, do away with tenured positions. In Wisconsin, now, the governor of Wisconsin,
Scott Walker,
has, for all intents and purposes, eliminated tenure. He's eliminated tenure. Well, and he's basically in bed with the Koch brothers.
But that's why state politics and local politics are really key places, and one might argue key battlegrounds, right? Because of people like the Koch brothers who have infested the university and are really moving to get rid of critical people like you, Henry, someone that does, not only are you a public intellectual, but, you know, you're a critical pedagogy scholar. I mean, this is really at the core of what it means to be a critical thinker, to go through higher education, to get a so-called liberal education. And these groups like the Koch brothers and others, including organizations like Project Veritas, they're trying to purge those voices and really expunge critical pedagogy from the curriculum. But this is also why, on the local level, this is maybe one of the few areas where people might be able to fight back, because the national political arena is completely infested with money, billionaire money, dark money, PACs, etc. It's almost impossible to get anybody that even uses language that people that study the public sphere or respect small d democratic Republican government would get. I'm not writing off national politics, but I'm curious about this, given that we are seeing these assaults on multiple layers of government. Do you think that we have a chance to push this back again at the local and state level?
Mickey, I'm with you on this, actually. I really think that local politics is central, because that's where people live. That's where they could get involved in narratives and in struggles that really, in a sense, touch their lives in a very immediate way, whether it's a struggle over public education or whether it's a struggle over higher education. It seems to me that the more abstract these issues become to people, particularly people who are new to politics, the more easy it is to fall into a sense of cynicism and powerlessness. So at one level, I think, yeah, I think it has to begin somewhere in ways that touch people's lives so they can have a sense that it matters to them, and they can identify with causes in ways that changes can take place that people can be connected with. The other side of this is that hopefully, as these local struggles emerge, they become broader. Even at the local level, you can struggle over public education, but then realize that what you're really struggling against is the issue of massive inequality and a kind of capitalism that's going to destroy all notions of the public good. So, yeah, I think that's very important. I mean, I think that in the best of all worlds, we have our feet in three or four places. But I think if we're talking about beginnings and we're talking about change that basically can be seen in a very immediate sense that was to empower people to engage in broader kinds of struggles. For me, I don't think there's any question but that the importance of the local level.
So, Henry, you've talked about how the mask has recently come off, revealing what you call the nightmare of neoliberal fascism. I'm wondering if long-term you feel that this mask coming off might be a good thing.
It's a terrific thing. I think that one of the things that has happened with this ruling elite is that they're unapologetic now. We live in a very different era politically, right? This is what's different from the older people who talked about fascism. Power is separated from politics. Power is global. Politics is local. And it seems to me that what that means is that they don't care about nation states anymore. You know, they don't care about apologizing to people. They don't care about legitimating ideologies. That's not to say they don't have cultural apparatuses that operate in doing everything they can to produce them and legitimate them. But I think that they feel more emboldened to act in their own interest in ways that allows them to feel that they can act with impunity. The whole enterprise has become more criminogenic. It's more criminal-like in both its attitude and in its practices. In that sense, the contradictions become increasingly difficult to hide. And I'll give you an example of what I'm talking about. My lovely wife, Susan, always says, give example. I've been reading recently, and I'm sure, Mickey, you know about this. I was surprised to read that when people talk about at the local level where the most important kinds of politics are taking place, they were talking about the red states. They were talking about these women who are organizing locally and nationally all over these red states around local elections, going door to door, holding educational groups. I was shocked. We never hear about this in the mainstream media. It's much too frightening to talk about. And I think in that sense, what Trump has done has made so clear what the contours of fascism are like. The war on women, the war on young people. Look at these young kids in Parkland who all of a sudden are saying, adults have let us down. I'm sorry. You know, you've written us out of the script of democracy. To be voiceless is to be powerless. And we're not going to put up with this anymore. You are not going to speak for us. And we are going to vote out anybody who supports the NRA. I mean, wow. In that sense, what are we seeing? We're seeing the bare face of neoliberal organizations, economic, political, ideological organizations that really can't legitimate themselves anymore. When you have a mass shooting a week, students are being killed all over the place, black people are being assaulted by the police, you know, for just walking down the street. It seems to me that something has to give. The language of everything's okay, there's no such thing as an alternative, everything is getting better, trickle-down theory is stunning and works, has exhausted itself. Now we need a new language. Remember Gramsci's saying, you know, the old is dying and the new is about to be born, and in the middle is a period of both barbarism and hope.
Well, Henry, I'm glad you brought up the students and youth, and you write about in the introduction of your book. You actually have a great quote from a Carnegie Knight investigation that says, for every U.S. soldier killed in Afghanistan during 11 years of war, at least 13 children were shot and killed in America. Every day in the United States, 7 kids and teens are shot dead, which adds up to 2,500 dead children a year. When is this going to sink in?
When it becomes more obvious and more visible.
Well, that's what Parkland, that's why Parkland was attacked immediately. And look who the victims were there, too, right?
Right. I mean, you know, can you imagine this right-wing nonsense, these nonsense media machines claiming that David Hogg was an actor or InfoWars, that moron from InfoWars.
Alex Jones. Right. Let's call him by name.
I mean, Alex Jones claiming it never took place and it was staged. Fortunately, he's being sued now by these parents. I think that what we're getting at here is that the level of the spectacle has become so insane, so conspiracy theory ridden, that while at some level, of course, there's a base that believes all this stuff, and they'll believe it right to the end. But there are more and more people who are realizing that we're not just talking about lies and the consistencies of lies. We're talking about a culture of cruelty that is so at odds with any sense of humanity, so at odds with any sense of justice, so at odds with any sense of democracy that people are saying, we've had enough.
Well, Henry Giroux, I actually want to continue on that point after the break. I'd like to remind listeners you're tuned to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, in studio here with Chase Palmieri. And we'll continue our conversation with Professor Henry Giroux after this brief musical break. Stay with us.
How could this be the land of the free, home of the brave, indigenous holocaust, and the home of the slaves, corporate America, dancing offbeat to the rhythm? You really think this country never sponsored terrorism? Human rights violations, we continue the saga. El Salvador and the Contras and Nicaragua. And on top of that, you still want to take me to prison just because I won't trade humanity for patriotism. It's like MK Ultra controlling your brains.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Chase Palmieri. Henry Giroux is a world-renowned educator, author, public intellectual. We are speaking with Henry for the hour today about his newest book. It's out right now on City Lights Books. It's City Lights Books' open media series, and Greg Ruggiero does a fantastic job editing that series. Henry's new book is called American Nightmare, Facing the Challenge of Fascism. And Henry, before the break, you were really breaking down this culture of cruelty, and we had been talking about youth. And I want to go back to this because, you know, again, in the beginning, in the introduction of your book, you know, you really lay out what's going on with young people from the juvenile justice system, debtor's prison for kids, which is a story we covered in Censored 2018, the school shootings, and the utter anti-intellectual practice of testing and rote memorization. It seems like schools are training grounds for this neoliberal fascist future, no?
Yes, absolutely. We need to situate that in a way that makes it more understandable. Remember, you know, as the social state begins to disappear under neoliberal austerity measures, one of the things that takes its place is the punishing state. And what that means is that the prison becomes the model in many ways for a lot of institutions, not all, but many. And schools are certainly one of them. And we have what somebody else once called punishment creep, this increasing criminalization of behavior on the part of both the state and federal governments in ways that basically make students suspects. I mean, think about what's going on in schools. I mean, students now are learning that schools are really about fear, security, not being able to trust anyone, and that the police are basically the most valuable resources they have in the school. That means you're educating a generation to believe that what really matters about schools doesn't matter at all.
Not only do we have that, we also have the lack of due process, a lack of transparency, a bloated administrative budget that cuts supplies from students and tax teachers, a corporate press and chamber of commerce in bed with the school boards that don't support teachers or students. And right here in my own hometown in Petaluma, we just saw the high school censor a valedictorian speech of a young woman who was sexually assaulted. And the school was trying to keep it under wraps, and they censored her speech. They told her she wasn't supposed to say it. She ended up reading it anyway. Fortunately, in this town, a lot of people have been coming to this young woman's defense, and I'm heartened to see that. But I've yet to hear any real definitive statement from the administration that makes any sense at all, other than one of sheer authoritarianism.
I think it's indicative of the utter lack of courage that some administrators have, who have sort of jumped in bed with this notion that schools are really about killing the imagination and censoring students and making life difficult for them and putting them in classes that are overcrowded, that lack resource, while at the same time, of course, the other side of this is punishing teachers, de-skilling them. You know, the endless number of stories we hear about teachers who now have two or three jobs in order to survive, who have to buy materials out of their own pockets for their kids, who give increasing amounts of time to children at the expense of their own families. This is outrageous. I mean, this is truly, when we talk about neoliberalism's culture of cruelty, what we really need to do is to change the language. We're talking about a war on youth. We're not just talking about youth who are being shortchanged. We're talking about a full-fledged war on the presupposition that the greatest index by which we can measure any society is how it treats its youth. And clearly, in this phase of neoliberal fascism, the United States has not failed. It's actually a failed state.
I'm afraid you're correct about that. That's why I'm kind of focusing here. I know the rest of your book is about many, many things, but I can't help but get away from how symbolic it is in terms of what's happening with the youth in this country.
Oh, it's just unreal. I mean, it's symbolic in multiple ways, right? In both dreadful and helpful ways. I mean, at one level, there's what we've talked about. You know, anything from the debtor prisons, I mean, to children being, their behavior being criminalized in schools, to increasing numbers of students being ushered into the school-to-prison pipeline. We have all of that. But at another level, we have students speaking out, like this young girl. You know, we have students mobilizing. We have the Black Lives Matter movement and a whole range of movements in which young black and brown people are mobilizing, using the new social media, talking to each other across national boundaries, as well as Me Too and Time's Up. And so it seems to me there is an ecosystem, an echo chamber, a culture emerging that in many ways, even without the platform of the mainstream media, is beginning to do something crucial, and that is the need to change the language. the need to rethink the very nature of politics and to stop equating democracy and capitalism.
That's a key point, Henry. And another one of the reasons that I'm really appreciative of your scholarship over the years and so many books is that by day I'm an historian. And so teaching history as well as critical media literacy, but teaching history in particular is providing relevant context for young people in particular, people of all ages, of course, but young people in particular to realize that they're not in an historical vacuum and that we got here somehow. Right? We have deliberately been driven to this current state. The corporate media wants to pretend it isn't happening or that it's normal. The plutocratic oligarchs are kind of busy fighting over the billionaire class and global domination. Meanwhile, things are decaying on multiple layers of the social strata.
When questions of historical consciousness no longer become relevant, when people can't learn from the past in a way to recognize problems that existed then that are now reproducing themselves in different forms today, politics ends. The lessons of history are not just pedagogical, they're political in the most profound sense, because that notion of consciousness is actually central to having the long view of what it means to move beyond a culture of immediacy, to move beyond a culture of shock, to move beyond a culture that trivializes and spectacularizes everything and begin to understand that there are other languages. There were modes of resistance. People did struggle even in the face of the most obscene and overwhelming odds. The Berlin Wall fell. It fell. Women have risen up. Young people have fought in the streets. Black people have taken their bodies and basically put them in places where they were assaulted in order to make sure that the war of injustice became the war of justice. So it seems to me that without historical memory, without this sense of what the past can teach us in terms of what we need to know and what we need to go beyond, is absolutely essential. And one could argue, of course, that the war on youth and the war on education is inextricably linked to the war on memory and historical consciousness.
Indeed, it is. And there's not only, of course, the war on the press, right? President Obama had a war on whistleblowers, to be sure. It went after more of them than any president. And here we have President Trump, the war on the press, right? He's constantly dragging the corporate media into this charade of fake news, right? And the real problem with that is that there is a fake news problem, because fake news isn't new. It's propaganda and it's disinformation. But the way that it's currently been weaponized and used, the president has been pulling the corporate media into it. And now they're using this as a Trojan horse to attack independent voices. I link this directly. The attack on the press is the same as the attack on memory, the attack on historical narrative, and the attack on emerging historiography, from the suppression of Howard Zinn all the way then to the banning of things like Counterpunch through Propernot and the Washington Post. These things are, in my mind, they're very, very linked. Today's fake news is tomorrow's fake history. And what we see happening in the establishment, in the Trump administration, and on down this neoliberal fascist manifestation is it's using these kind of terms to shut down debate, to shut down factual counter narratives, and actually punish people for trying to explore them.
It has three elements. First of all, it creates a world in which it's impossible to separate fact from fiction, falsehood from reality. Thirdly, it does something else. It eliminates the ethical imagination, the ability for people to distinguish between good and bad. Because when people don't believe informed judgments matter based on evidence, based on historical consciousness, based on memory, based on a certain notion of shared reality, they're open to a kind of fascist ideology. They're open to the assumption that anything can be said, anything can be true, and it doesn't matter what you believe in, and you don't really have to worry about being able to recognize the evil things that people do to people or how evil institutions work. Fourthly, it seems to me it does something that I would say offers a larger, capacious term for everything you've just talked about. It destroys civic literacy. It's an attack on civic literacy.
This is all part, in my view, it's all part of this neoliberal fascist slide. And again, I mean, we can go back a ways, but I really see it coming out of a reaction to the civic movements and engagements and social justice movements in the 1960s, coming out of the Lewis Powell memo and Nixon and the right-wing purge of civic society.
Nobody wants to talk about this. Nobody wants to talk about the fact that they never got over what happened in the 60s. Whether we're talking about the Powell memo or whether we're talking about the Trilateral Commission report, they talk about the excesses of democracy. the thought that people from different groups, different identities, could actually go into the university and come out and in some way be active and critical citizens. The notion that the university could be defined as a democratic public sphere, the notion that we could expand the culture and the institutions that made democracy possible, so frightened them that they would rather turn to authoritarianism and fascism than to turn to even a weak social contract and a weak notion of democracy in order to defend it.
That's where we are, Henry. And this is why I'm glad you're riffing on this. And this is another reason why, again, I think you're certainly well-known in your field. In my view, your books should be on everybody's coffee table. I mean that you're someone that connects all these historical dots and puts it all together. Nolan Higdon and I actually just finished a book earlier this spring, and we're hoping it'll be out on City Lights later in the year. But it hits on this very point, that the right wing never got over how democratic and public institutions could be used in the public interest and for the public good and might chip away at their overall cultural and political hegemony.
And by the way, you are one of the few people who really does this. And I say this because it is so central to any form of emancipatory politics. You have to connect these dots. You've got to bring these issues together so you realize and become aware of how they mutually inform each other. Or otherwise you're caught, you're lost. You know, you're lost in silos that will never tell you enough.
I'd like to remind listeners, you're tuned to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. I'm in studio here with Chase Palmieri. And we are speaking with public intellectual and scholar, prolific author, Professor Henry Giroux. We're going to conclude our conversation with Henry Giroux after this brief musical break. Stay with us.
Freedom. We're talking about your freedom. Freedom to choose what to do with your body. Freedom to believe what you like. Freedom for brothers to love one another. Freedom for black.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Chase Palmieri. On today's program, we're speaking with the renowned author and public intellectual Henry Giroux. He currently holds the professorship for scholarship in the public interest and the Paulo Freire Distinguished Scholar Chair in Critical Pedagogy at McMaster University. His most recent book is American Nightmare, and we're talking about neoliberal fascism, and we're now going to go into our final segment of our conversation. And Chase Palmieri, I think you have a question for Henry.
Yes, Henry, you mentioned how politics takes its lead from culture. So I'm wondering if by that theory that all fascism takes rise as a populist movement.
I think that populist movements are always a part of fascism. They're central to fascism. They're not the only force. But I think that when we ignore the way in which culture functions so as to misdirect rage, so as to instill in people the most racist logics, to make the claim to racial purity, to lead people to believe that only hierarchies matter. I mean, think about this public intellectual who's emerged here, Jordan Peterson in Canada. They call him a best-selling public intellectual. He's an anti-public intellectual. And the nonsense that this guy preaches, that young people are sort of flocking to, you know, women should be in their place, men have to exert this really tough kind of masculinity, this kind of regressive crap we've seen attacked for the last 200 years, all of a sudden in the media becomes fashioned on as part of the spectacle that allows them to increase their audiences and their profits. And all of a sudden, you know, it feeds into the alt-right movement. But in the reading that I do about the 30s and the 40s and the rise of fascism in Italy and what happens in Germany, the question of culture is absolutely central to those movements. The ways in which you could take the collective imagination and rethink it, reformulate it, so as to have it turn against itself so that it had nothing to do with democracy and everything to do with fascism or everything to do with genocide or everything to do with the logic of disposability and militarization. It's just amazing. I think that when we underestimate the educative nature of culture, when we underestimate the fact that education is centered to politics, especially at this moment when all of a sudden you have this new media, you have a very powerful set of cultural apparatuses, and you have a politics and a notion of power that integrates with them in ways unlike we have ever seen before, ever. I'm old. This is a different age. I wrote my books with a pen and pencil and typewriter. Wow. The way in which knowledge now diffusing of politics, knowledge, identity, and agency has taken on the distinctiveness unlike we've ever seen before. And the left still has to catch up with this.
I think so. And Henry Giroux, it's also the case that just because our technology is one click, one tweet, one like or share away, we can't think any faster. And a lot of these issues that are going on are complicated and they have long historical roots. And that takes time to process, integrate, and understand. And in our current technocratic culture, we don't seem to want to take the time or don't make the time or don't have the time because of other pressures in the economy working against us. So this is quite a confluence here that we're facing.
I mean, there are two logics at work here, right? You've pointed to both of them. And for me, they're central to my work. One is that let's make it clear that time is a deprivation for most people. Most people are not dealing with what it means to get ahead. They're dealing with what it means to survive. This is the age of precarity. There are no longer long-term jobs. Everybody's burdened down by loans if they're students and young people, or they're working in jobs that are meaningless, or they're working for free, or they're not working at all. Secondly, it seems to me, we're bombarded by a culture that lives in the moment. Words now can't catch up with thoughts. It's increasingly difficult to do that. Nobody reads books anymore. Everybody's online. Couple that with the social atomization that we see emerging everywhere in the United States. I mean, you know the figures. More people commit suicide in the United States than basically are killed in the opioid crisis and by cars.
Well, indeed, and we know more people in the military are committing suicide than dying in the imperial wars. It goes on and on. Henry Giroux, I would be really remiss if I missed this opportunity, because you have a fantastic chapter, one that's central to a lot of the things that I teach. You have a whole chapter on George Orwell and Aldous Huxley. And, of course, you talk about the Orwellian nightmare and the dystopian surveillance state. And, of course, not long ago, Edward Snowden quipped that Facebook is basically a surveillance company rebranded as social media. He basically said it was one of the greatest propaganda achievements since the Department of War called itself the Department of Defense. But you also write about Huxley, and Neil Postman wrote about this in Amusing Ourselves to Death, this juxtaposition. You talk about Huxley's world of manufactured ignorance. Can you expand a little on that?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I was trying to say was that under neoliberal fascism and the rise of the corporate state, we have the emergence of massive disimagination machines. And those disimagination machines are the contemporary version of Huxley's notion of soma. You know, they put people to sleep. They promote lies. They talk about fake news as a way to simply divert all kinds of criticism and to not make power accountable, while at the same time to disparage dissent and to threaten those people who produce dissent. So it seems to me that unlike many theorists who will either pit Huxley and of course, Orwell against each other, I claim you have to understand them in this day and age as merging.
It seems like a 1-2 punch to me, and I think that your approach to it is spot on.
Henry, I know you speak to education as one of the solutions here, but I'm wondering if you can address this question. In order to defeat a fascist uprising while it's taking place, would a society have to realign itself within a different competing populist movement?
Yes, absolutely. Chase, if I'm interpreting the question correctly, it seems to me that we need to rescue the notion of populism from simply its right-wing versions. Nobody wants to talk about Sanders. That was a populist movement. Nobody wants to talk about the Parkland students as a new form of populism. Nobody wants to talk about these teachers all over the red states who are walking out and protesting and striking. When we talk about populism, all we talk about are right-wingers. This is... It doesn't work because it's a way of suggesting on the part of the mainstream press that the only populism that matters is a populism of people who are basically, in their terms, dumb, stupid. They don't know anything. They're ignorant. This is nonsense. That's just another way of basically disparaging working class people. That's how I read that. But I think that Chase is absolutely right. Let's go back. When we talk about Vaclav Havel's notion that politics follows culture, we need to take what it means to change consciousness seriously in ways in which the educational apparatuses that we deal with, whether they be in the schools, in higher education, whether they be in the marginalized media, these all matter. Chase had asked me a question earlier that we didn't follow up on. He says, well, you know, I talk about higher education as structures of domination. They are structures of domination, but they're also structures of struggle. Domination is never so overwhelming that the only way you can talk about power in those institutions is by making it synonymous with domination. I never believed that. I don't believe that for any institution.
No, Henry, but another thing, too, and again, we're about out of time here, but this is what I, again, really cherish about your arguments in your books, is that you do bring it back around like we just did, and you write at the end of your book that the American nightmare is not something happening somewhere else to someone else. It's happening here to us. The time to wake up is now. And you end with a great quote from James Baldwin in a letter to Angela Davis. Again, it's very timely. And you write, according to Baldwin, some of us, white and black, know how great a price has already been paid to bring into existence a new consciousness, a new people, an unprecedented nation. If we know and do nothing, we are worse than the murderers hired in our name. If we know, then we must fight for your life as though it were our own, which it is, and render impassable with our bodies the corridor to the gas chamber. For if they take you in the morning, they will be coming for us that night. And you say that in the end, there's no democracy without informed citizens, no justice without a language critical of injustice, and no change without a broad-based movement of collective resistance. Hear, hear, Henry Giroux. Again, I could not agree more. Thank you so much for your important work. Your latest book is called American Nightmare, Facing the Challenge of Fascism. It's out now on City Lights Books, Open Media Series. Henry Giroux, could you direct our listeners to a website and places where they can follow your work? And I really want to promote the work that you do, and I want our listeners to be able to find it.
My website is www.henryagiroux.com. But I also want to direct people to a whole range of websites. I mean, that places like Truthout, places like Truth Dig, places like Salon, places like Counterpunch, Rise Up Time, Alternet. There is a range of sources out there that are really informative and smart and need to be discovered and read.
Henry Giroux, thanks so much for joining us again on the Project Censored show. Always a delight to hear from you and hear your thoughts about what's going on around the world and, of course, here in the United States. Your latest book, American Nightmare, Facing the Challenge of Fascism. Henry Giroux, thanks for joining us on the Project Censored show.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain.
And that concludes today's Project Censored show. I'm Mickey Huff. The Project Censored show is heard on over 40 stations around the United States, from Maui to New York. I'm your executive producer and host, Mickey Huff, along with our senior producer, Anthony Fest. Special thanks to Dennis Murphy. To learn more about the Project Censored show or to get involved in any of our ongoing activities, find us online at projectcensored.org. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next time.
Think about crimes perpetrated by criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguised under the guise of democracy, politics, the apocalypse, got the skies like the ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison, genocide, wars, fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by taxing while the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, and the times for the master thief, divine conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Times running out the reach, all potential fame at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio.
time of useful consciousness.
Nomi Prince, Collusion, How Central Bankers Rigged the World. Nomi Prince was invited by the Santa Fe Lannan Foundation to give one of their prestigious talks. She took the stage at the Lensic Performing Arts Center in January 2018. Before her, Terry Tempest Williams, Glenn Greenwald, Arundhati Roy, Oscar Martinez, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, and many others had spoken there. Nomi Prince was introduced by Juliet Shore, professor of sociology at Boston College. Shore focuses on the economy, environmental sustainability, women's issues, wealth inequality, and consumerism. Here first is Juliet Shore, followed by excerpts of the talk by Nomi Prince.
Nomi is a former banker, an author, a journalist, a senior fellow at Demos, and a very accomplished public speaker. She is a leading voice in our country on the role of finance in economics and politics. While she was still in college, she began working in finance at what was then called Chase Manhattan Bank. And afterwards, she took a full-time job at the bank as an analyst. She subsequently had a meteoric rise at a number of leading financial institutions, Lehman Brothers, where she created the financial analysts department, at Bear Stearns, where she spent 7 years running their analytics department, and eventually she went on to Goldman Sachs, where she was a managing director. Nomi would later write that in the U.S. we have government by Goldman and for Goldman. Prince has an amazing insider's seat, in particular the global financial collapse of 2008, which she details in her most recent book, Collusion, How Central Bankers Rigged the World. After 9/11, Prince left Goldman, in part after being told that she should not consider her clients to actually be her customers, but she should be working to please senior management, and that didn't sit too well with her. Since then, she's had a remarkable career as a writer and a journalist with a series of always heavily researched, engrossing books. In 2004, she wrote Other People's Money, The Corporate Mugging of America, which warned us about the financial debacle to come, and of course, she was one of the first and only insiders to warn about what would later occur with the collapse of 2008. She wrote It Takes a Pillage in 2009, which is Anatomy of the Crash. Wonderful titles. And then her magisterial All the President's Bankers in 2014, which is a book looking at a century of political influence by six behemoth financial institutions. And we're very fortunate tonight to have her. If you will all join me now in welcoming Nomi Prince.
Thank you for that lovely trip down my life. and thank you all so much for being here tonight. You know, special thanks. It's an honor to be speaking here on behalf of the Lannan Foundation. I want to step sort of back into how I am viewing what's going on, how it's really a manifestation of where we have been in the last 10 years since the financial crisis. I was on Wall Street when the financial crisis was being concocted, and one of the things I did back then when I started to have some negative thoughts about the industry of which I had been a part since I was 19, since I started at Chase, was that it was starting to collapse the world. So even in the late 1990s, we had an Asian crisis. We had a Russian and Eastern European crisis. There was problems manifesting throughout the world that were results of the things that banks were doing with respect to pushing debt and different types of transactions and securities onto less informed and less capable of repaying that debt countries. And one of the things that I actually mentioned to some students today, I don't know if they're here, is that the uniqueness of being there in banking at Bear Stearns and going to something which was a huge demonstration in a city called Birmingham in the United Kingdom. And in Birmingham, many people from around Europe were coming and joining together to participate in a demonstration that was called Jubilee 2000. And the idea of Jubilee 2000 was that people should realize that the debt incurred upon countries that could not afford to repay it by banks and governments that could, and that had the wherewithal to achieve funds to repay debt if they took it on, but pushed it on other countries, was something that was unsustainable. And so there I was working as, at the time, a senior managing director of Bear Stearns, and sort of having all these thoughts about how unright this was. And I took off on a Friday to go on a weekend to drive up to Birmingham. And I was in a church before the demonstration, and there was a woman there named Ann Pettifor. She's a brilliant economist, very progressive. Now she, among many of the other things that she's done in her lifetime, advises Parliament on issues that relate to actual real populism and real economics and foundational economics. But by the time she'd come back from Africa, where there was a lot of problems, she had traversed through Africa, and she was just talking about the sort of devastation and the poverty on the ground, and a lot of it at the hands of sort of financial complex transactions that various governments had taken their own cuts of and then sort of imposed upon the people in their various countries. And she started to talk about these stories, and she started to just cry, you know, and I'm sitting there in this church, and you know, I got to go back to my day job at the bank on Monday, and it just kind of struck a real chord. And years later, I wrote to her and I said, you know, almost 20 years later, I was in this church, you know, at Jubilee 2000 in Birmingham, and I saw you, and like, oh my God, you're now sort of talking with a colleague of mine, and this is kind of the trajectory of where life has taken me, has taken the world, because on a lot of many elements, the world is so much less stable than it was in 1999. The debt that's been incurred upon these countries is so much worse than it was at the time, and nothing has really changed. In fact, in many instances, it has become significantly worse. And I just want to tell you that what you said to those people in that church before 1.5 million of us or so were holding hands around Birmingham and talking about canceling this debt, which didn't happen, that really struck a chord. And I just want to thank you. And she was very sweet. And we're now Twitter pals and everything else. And I hope to see her when I go to London to actually talk at Parliament when my book comes out. So the current book, in the process of writing it, I went around the world again. And I went around the world from Mexico to Brazil to Japan to China to throughout Europe and so forth. But different than I did when I was a banker. I was a junior sort of analyst on the futures and options desk at Lehman Brothers in the early 90s. And the things that we did back then were sort of the nascent financial engineering elements of what became derivatives, of what became toxic assets, of what ultimately imploded the financial system in 2008. But back then, they were sort of simpler. So when 2008 happened, it was because our banks like now J.P. Morgan Chase, Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns, which don't exist anymore, Goldman Sachs, Bank of America, and so forth, were Citigroup, were creating toxic assets or manufacturing new securities out of subprime loans. That's a kind of old story at this point. But I just want to explain a little bit of it because it relates to where we are today and how the same stuff is going on just on a broader scale and just kind of in more secret at the same time. Toxic assets or securitized stuff, whether it is securitized subprime mortgages or corporate loans or debt or toll road payments or wine receipts. Doesn't matter. But the idea is that you are sticking a bunch of stuff into a larger security and it's supposed to pay interest. And based on how much interest it pays into that security, the security is then cut up into other pieces and it itself pays interest to the investors or the buyers of those pieces. And there is something called a waterfall or hierarchy about those pieces called tranches. And the idea is that you have kind of an order. And if you buy what's considered to be the most purest piece, the piece that's going to get its interest payments first and therefore pay the investors their interest payments first for buying it, that's a higher rated piece. That's a AAA piece. You start to go down the slices or the tranches of that security, you get to the bottom at something called an equity tranche. And the reason it's called an equity tranche or an equity piece is because it will not pay out anything until all of the other payments have gone out to all the other different investors that have bought all of the different slices of this larger security. The problem is if no interest payments are going into the security, or if there is fraud about the amount of interest payments going into the security, nothing comes out. So nobody gets paid. And ultimately, 60 to 70% of the worst assets that were created during the financial crisis by the major banks who then sold them on to different countries and different municipalities and pension funds and so forth weren't paying anything. That's why the financial crisis happened, because what happens when banks aren't able to receive from each other the payments that they bought and sold on some of these securities in the process of selling them elsewhere, they start to close their doors. They either close their doors sort of forever and companies go bankrupt, like Bear Stearns, which almost did, but instead got sold to J.P. Morgan Chase, and Lehman Brothers, which just kind of dissipated. But otherwise, these institutions stopped trusting each other, and the system collapsed. And what happened in the wake of that collapse was both a political and a monetary solution to the collapse and to fix what was called the systemic or the emergency systemic problem of the financial system, which was to infuse these banks with money. So not only did we, as a government, bail them out, which was a small portion of the sort of subsidies they received, the largest banks, but also our main central bank, the Federal Reserve, got involved in manufacturing money in order to repay them. So rather than, say, fixing some of these assets, some of these actual mortgages that made up these securities, which would have been a far cheaper solution, and we wouldn't be anywhere near the situation of instability that we are actually in today, they decided to instead infuse these same banks with more money. Now, what happened in the wake of the financial crisis with respect to private banks from the central banks is nothing like that. What has happened in the last 10 years and starting in 2008 is that the Federal Reserve led all of the other major central banks to infuse their private banking system with a lot of money. How do they do this? By a strategy called quantitative easing. You're giving them money and you're buying stuff from them in return to make it look like you're having an equal exchange. You're basically buying either treasury bonds back from these private banks, who, as I mentioned to you, are basically in the center of the Treasury Department and where they sell those Treasury bonds to anyway. So you're creating a triangle where the Federal Reserve effectively buys Treasury bonds, starting, it's one of the elements of quantitative easing, the first round, QE1, bought Treasury bonds from the banks that got them from the Treasury Department and gave them back to the Fed, and the Fed gave them cash. The U.S. issues debt, and the banks get money. I mean, that's what it is. And the reason it's easing is because if you buy treasury bonds, the price of them goes up. If anyone buys them, right? If anybody buys anything and there's enough demand for it, you know, the price will go up. In bond math, if the price goes up, the rate goes down. And that was how the Fed not only kept rates down from engineering rates down, from saying the Fed funds rate, the rate that banks pay each other to borrow money, we are going to keep calibrating downward to zero, which they did. But in order to keep it there, we're also going to give them money, buy bonds, have the price of the bonds go up, have the rates go down, and that's going to just be an additional sort of downward pressure on rates. And then they didn't just buy treasury bonds from these banks, they also bought their crappy mortgage bonds. So the 35% of mortgage bonds that didn't sort of combust are hanging out at some of these banks, or they're hanging out as composites of other pieces of mortgage bonds at some of these banks, and nobody's buying them because they're crap. So the Fed decides to buy them. So what that does is it doesn't just give the banks who were holding them more cash in return for the Fed taking those bonds. It also means that because there was demand, even though it was the Fed who was demanding these bonds, they can reprice upward all the other crap they have on their books. It's true, right? I mean, if you have a garage sale and you put all your, like, crappy couches and, like, old TVs and chipped mugs and stuff in one place, and someone's like, oh, I got this really cool chip mug. It's awesome. I just paid $100 for it. Then you're going to mark up your next chip mug. You're not going to be like, well, it's only actually worth 50 cents. And that's exactly what banks did. They're like, okay, the Fed altogether collectively bought $4.5 trillion worth of bonds from the banks. Trillion. So the GDP of the United States now is just under $20 trillion. So that's like 25% of GDP equivalent. But it's also an even higher percentage of the assets that the big six banks are and were holding. It's about 60 to 65% equivalent to the assets that the top six banks are holding. So it's a lot of cash to be infused into banks in order to get crappy bonds or even treasury bonds. But that's the current status of the Fed's book. Now, there's different things they could have done instead with that money. They could have, for example, helped to fortify the mortgages of people who had been screwed by the banks. They could have decided to, you know, build better highways. They could have decided to, you know, have high-speed trains like they do in China and Japan that actually work and are awesome. I'm from California. I live partly in LA and in a town called Ojai, which was affected by the Thomas Fire in December. I evacuated the first night from the fire, you know, and it's not like the Fed's money could have kept the fire from occurring, but the Fed's money could have, or in general, conceptually, prevented the damage that the mudslides incurred upon surrounding towns after the fire, because there would have been actual funding to create sustainable methods of keeping slides down when the rains came, which was an inevitable sort of seasonal thing. It's something that's happened in New Mexico as well. I mean, there's things that money could have been used or set aside for rather than simply buying these crappy bonds or buying debt that otherwise would not have been needed from the Treasury Department. Other things could have been done with that money. They weren't. And it wasn't just the Fed that was doing this. What happened was the Fed decided to sustain our financial system in this manner. But it also was like, well, it's a global world. These financial markets are interlocked. These banks are interdependent. They trade with each other. Their investors borrow from them significantly to then go and buy other assets, stocks, bonds, and so forth. Like, we can't just have one country try to monitor its rates and buy bonds from its banks to keep rates down and money into these banks. We have to make this global. And so what the Fed did was it got the European Central Bank involved, and it got the Bank of Japan involved, and Switzerland, and it basically said, look, we need this to happen collectively. Now, these banks didn't necessarily face the same initial crises that the U.S. faced, because for the most part, it was our banks that screwed up the entire world. It really wasn't the other banks. The other banks were a part of it, but they didn't have the same impact because they hadn't been manufacturing the toxic assets in the amounts that our banks manufactured them and sold them on to the rest of the world. So collectively, the major central banks in the world didn't just manufacture the $4.5 trillion that the Fed manufactured to go into our banking system instead of going into anything real. They manufactured almost $22 trillion. And they are still holding the assets, the bonds that they bought with this money they manufactured on their books. And this is just the G7 central banks. So it's effectively taken a decade of this process to continue, and it's still continuing, to really manifest what's an artificial market. So we look at the stock market, which is, you know, roaring, you know, up at, you know, historic highs, going from 24, 25, 26,000 and so forth. And we have a president who's taking credit for that. And not that the last president didn't also take credit. I mean, this finance is completely bipartisan. It really doesn't matter what whoever's in power says. There are legislation issues that do matter. But from the standpoint of money in, money out, it really doesn't make a difference. The capital doesn't care. And so what's happened in the last year is what had been happening over the last 10 years, which is that markets have been bolstered by this central bank money that's gone into the private banks, that's gone into the major speculators, and that has lifted all these asset classes up to make up for the fact that rates are generally, on average, 0% for these banks. So in order to keep that entire global 0%, if the Fed starts to raise its rates, which it did for the first time by 25 basis points at the end of 2015, and then several times in 2016, three times last year. They've raised them a bit from zero, but other banks have lowered theirs or grown their quantitative easing measures. So the net result globally, collaboratively or collusively, is that we maintain this system where central banks are effectively lifting these markets. And then you add in things like the GOP tax plan. And what does that do? It enables companies who have been spending the last number of years buying their own stock with cheap money because they get to borrow at cheaper rates because, A, rates are down everywhere, and, B, their sort of bank mentors are working with them to create this debt because then they make money. They're effectively continuing now with an additional tax cut to buy more of their shares. So this isn't like they are actually paying people more or they are creating more jobs or creating more infrastructure or anything like that. And they've said this. They've admitted this. This is all sort of public knowledge. They are simply buying their own shares. And all of it has been connected to these policies of basically infusing the system with cheap money and allowing it to artificially stimulate the markets. That's not an inherently stable system. Any sort of alteration too quickly could unravel all of what's happened in the last 10 years. And when they unravel debt markets first. They unravel the companies that borrowed money, borrow too much relative to what they were able to bring in, the countries that borrow too much money, the countries that borrow too much money in dollars, as the dollar has been declining in the wake of all of these sort of bizarre policies. And ultimately, defaults or the inability to repay this debt starts to become the norm. It's not really there yet. Because they're sitting there trying to figure out how not to make that happen. So in terms of just ending on a sort of more positive note, there's a couple things that can be done. And again, both of them are things that I've been trying to talk to our Congress people about, and you guys can help, just bother them. It's always good. Our banking system has not been reformed. It's not been restructured. We've not returned to a Glass-Steagall environment, which is something, if any of you have read any of the work I've done, I've been advocating since before I left Wall Street. What happens now is all of that artificial money, all of that extra subsidy that's going into the banking system is doing so, and it's collateralized by our deposits. So if a bank wants to buy its own stock, which Jamie Dimon announced J.P. Morgan would do to the tune of $19 billion last year, and that's just 1 year. They're doing it on the back of not giving it as services, let's say, or additional interest payments to its own depositors, but they're doing it because, like, they can, and no one's going to say anything about it. And that's because the depositors and the checking accounts are in the same institution as the other side of the institution, which gets to trade and gets to reformulate new toxic assets and structured products. But now they're not made out of mortgages. They're made out of all that corporate debt and all the corporate loans that have been given out cheaply over these 10 years because rates have been so low. And so the same thing will happen again when those combust. There has been no change in the way in which they operate or the securities that they create, except for, like, the stuffing. So instead of, like, a cherry pie, it's a blueberry pie. It's still a pie. So that needs to happen. Those things need to be separate because then you get to a situation where when you play blackjack as a bank, you're playing with your own money. Then you're playing with your shareholders' money and not the implicit guarantee that the government will be there to back you because you are holding insured depositors' money of millions of people in your country and millions of people in other countries to their private banks throughout the world. So that's something that needs to happen. And also infrastructure. Like things need to get built from this money. You could take $4.5 trillion of the debt that's sitting on the assets that are sitting on the Fed's book and just divert some of them into, for example, a public bank or an infrastructure bank where you can actually use that to fund real growth. And whether that is from an engineering perspective, whether that's from a research perspective, whether that is from, you know, rebuilding areas, you know, in terms of levees, in terms of, like, reducing, you know, mudslide danger, whatever it might be, having higher speed railways, competing with the rest of the world from that component, rather than having to quibble, which is what the current infrastructure conversation is in Washington, about whether or not $200 billion, Fed has $4.5 trillion, whether $200 billion of federal money can go in into an infrastructure bill and be matched by $800 billion from states to build infrastructure. So what is being discussed by both parties, but sort of debated, is whether this $1 trillion infrastructure bill, which is less than a quarter of the amount that the Fed manufactured to buy bonds, it can even be $1 trillion of federal money. It's not even being discussed at that level. It's $200 billion of federal money. That's what's being discussed. That does not grow a country. And that is something that's going on throughout the world. I mean, it's worse here because we were the country that sustained our banks with the most amount of liquidity from our central bank, and then we exported that type of a strategy. In China, for example, they also manufacture money, and they also create a lot of debt, and they also have a top-heavy system from that perspective. But they are using it to actually build infrastructure in China, but also to create trade alliances throughout Southeast Asia and even with respect to Latin America and Mexico and countries that are sort of being excluded now from trade policy talks with the United States and or just having problems politically and are basically not just trying to impose politics on them. They're trying to give them funds with which to build infrastructure throughout the world. Are there problems with China and how they do things? Yes. Are there problems with how we do things? Yes. But there is funding going on for real development. And real development creates actual jobs, and actual jobs create the manifestation of actual wages, and actual wages get used to buy things in the actual economy as opposed to being done on just sort of borrowed money, which is just then part of this whole pyramid of debt that's been created since the crisis. So those are things that can be done. So this arc that's gotten me in front of you today, and again, I'm very honored to be here. I'm really thrilled you all came out, is part of really trying to dissect what's happened in the world even before I was involved in the financing of it, but also see where we can go from here. Money and economics is actually it's a people's thing. It's not something that needs to just be dictated by the individuals that gather for champagne and skiing, whatever, at Davos. They're the things that like we need to do, and we can do. We can do it by every decision we make every day. So with that, I just want to, again, thank you for listening and for being here and giving this evening to each other.
That was former Wall Street executive turned whistleblower Nomi Prinz. She spoke on January 24, 2018 at the Lannan Foundation in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Her recent book is Collusion: How Central Bankers Rigged the World. For the full audio or video, go to the website of the Lannan Foundation and search for Nomi Prinz, NOMIPRINS. The Lannan Foundation is a family foundation dedicated to cultural freedom, diversity, and creativity. They support exceptional contemporary artists and writers, as well as Native activists in rural indigenous communities. Come back when TUC Radio returns for an interview of Nomi Prinz by Juliet Shore that followed the talk. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.
I think we're joined now by Freddy Usabuera. Are you there, Freddy?
Yes, I am, Phil.
Well, thank you very much. People should know you are, of course, a Rwandan expatriate, I guess is the expression. And you led or participated in the leadership of a demonstration at the G7 in Quebec City. I was impressed. Le Soleil and others covered your gave more attention, I would say, to your protest of the presence of Paul Kagame, president of Rwanda. First of all, well, why did you decide to go to the G7, and what was the message?
Thanks, Phil, for having me today. First of all, I'd like just to, to send my greetings to everyone who's following us on radio, and thank you also for thinking to have me with you today. The reason why, actually, we decided to go and, in Quebec, it's because just a few days ago, I believe it was the beginning of last week, Monday, Tuesday, we have learned through Twitter from our Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, who who just sent a message out saying that out of the seven leaders of the G7 invited for the G7 summit in Quebec, he had also invited, 12 other leaders, mm-hmm. as they always do. Mm-hmm. And one of those leaders invited to the G7 this time was Paul Kagame, the president of Rwanda.
Mm-hmm.
And once we found out that information, we were really shocked. We were shocked because, as you might know, or as also whomever is following us might know, Kagame has been accused of being a war criminal and also accused of having killed so many people in Rwanda, in Congo, in Burundi, and even before that in Uganda, because what people have to know is that before Kagame became the president of Rwanda, he was one of the chief in the armies of Museveni in Uganda. You know, the army of Museveni that helped him to take power in 1986 in Uganda. Mm-hmm. And Kagame was in charge of the secret services. At that time, he was very young. He was, I believe, in his 20s. And, people can go on the net and check exactly what happened back then. And after that, when they created their army, the RPF, the Rwandan Patriotic Front, Kagame just led the war and ended up taking power in Rwanda after the genocide of 1994. And as the reports that have been coming out since then show, there are the reports from the UN specialist of human rights, reports from Human Rights Watch or even Amnesty International, and some other specialists, who have worked on the case in Rwanda, have confirmed without no doubt that Kagame has his hand in what happened in the genocide of Rwanda.
April 1994.
Yes. That's right. That was April 1994, what has been called the genocide against the Tutsi. But we have to remember that the Hutus and Tutsis have been killed. Tutsis killed for who they are, for being Tutsis. And Hutus also killed in some cases, in many cases, by the RPF, for who they are, for the ethnic.
Well, I just want to make sure, just to say, and I know you must have seen it, there was a feature article by Judy Reaver, author of In Praise of Blood. She mm-hmm. concurs with you, and she makes that point in her book, In Praise of Blood, that the first attacks, the opening of the war in October 1990, were the RPF troops who were at that time still very much in Ugandan mode. Some of them were still officers and soldiers in the Ugandan army. When they entered Rwanda, the first uh-huh. victims were Hutus.
Yes, they were. I mean, the war started on the 1st of October, 1990. And at that time, actually, when the RPF attacked Rwanda, what they have put out is that there were refugees, they were being refused to go back to the country. But nobody knew, in the back of their head that they had another agenda, which with time, people realized that actually the agenda was not to return, but to take power in Rwanda by force. Mm-hmm. So Rwanda was attacked by the Ugandan army led by Kagame. And every time where they were moving and attacking, they were killing a massive, massive population. And I thank you for mentioning Judy Reaver's book, In Praise of Blood, because in her book that she has written just actually from the 1996 up to date, Mm-hmm. You know, she had done a tremendous job, you know, of investigation. She has done more than 200 interviews with the people who were close to Kagame, his counselors and his advisors, you know, members of his army, who have confirmed that people that have been killed in Rwanda, especially for the Hutus, they were planned. They were planned to kill them. So there was a plan to eliminate as much number as they can, you know, of mm-hmm. Hutus. And also, what she confirms also that has been said by several other reports is that even in the genocide of the Tutsis, you know, Kagame has done so much to infiltrate the militias in Interahamwe so they can kill as many Tutsis as they can, you know, and, you know, which mm-hmm. sometimes when you read the book, you know, you get chills. You can't understand how somebody who's saying that he saved the lives of Tutsis but is one who planned to, you know, for them to be killed just mm-hmm. with one objective, to take power.
Yes.
That's chilling. Yeah. So that's the reason why, actually, that's the reason why we have, you know, decided to go in Quebec and, you know, mm-hmm. Show how much we disagree of the decision of Justin Trudeau.
Yes.
Because it's we can't understand as a Canadian how our government can decide to invite somebody who rolled the red carpet to a criminal like him.
Yes,
and
there's unanimity in the Rwandan community, which I think that has been ignored. David Himbara, who has an excellent site, I urge people, he tweets, and he's very much in support of your demonstration. He served in the Kagame administration, witnessed it, you might say, intimately, and very nearly was killed himself. He was at risk. And I traveled recently to Europe, and I was attended meetings. The Rwandans coming together, I would have said, talking to them, they were about half Hutu, half Tutsi, and they were of one opinion.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
he is oppressing them as Rwandans, Tutsi or Hutu. He's oppressing.
Yes, yes. Actually, what happened? I mean, which confirms exactly what we have been saying for years, for more than, you know, ever since Kagame took power, mm-hmm. is that Kagame did not take power to help, you know, Rwandans, because as it seems like the man himself, he's there just for his own interests, you know, mm-hmm. because if you look at Rwanda now, that's the reason why even we went to Quebec to ask, to show the Quebecois and others that we don't understand the reason why he's invited, you know, mm-hmm. He controls 85% of the economy of Rwanda. You know, he has killed children, women, and whomever tried.
And he has political prisoners. He has Diane Wigara, who is Tutsi, comes from a prominent family there. Mm-hmm. She and her mother are both in prison, along with Victoire Ingabire. Could you talk about those two prisoners?
Yes. Actually, what happened is in 2010, Victoire Ingabire, who actually is a young lady, I mean, I can say she's young because under 50, mm-hmm. she went in 2010, you know, to represent herself as a candidate for the presidency. You know, she got into Rwanda, and during the genocide, she was not in Rwanda. She was studying in Europe. She had been outside the country for over 15 years, you know. Mm-hmm. So she returned to Rwanda with the idea of trying to bring democracy and help build Rwanda, and, you know, especially, you know, supporting the Rwandans to move ahead and to move on with a free country, you know. And mm-hmm. then when she got there, the first thing that Kagame did was to arrest her, accuse her of being a genocide denier and also being a genocidaire.
And he shaved her head.
That's right. And the lady was never in Rwanda during the time of the genocide. But it's just because he felt that if she was to run, she would win the election.
Yes.
So she was a Hutu. Then she got accused of being a genocidaire.
Yes.
But then, 2015, You know, I don't know if our Canadian fellow, you don't know, but he changed the constitution to be elected, you know, to go for a third term, which was not allowed. And then this new young lady, courageous lady, very young, you know, she's a Tutsi. She presented herself as a candidate. And the next thing she saw, they managed to publish modified pictures, you know, showing her as naked, just, you know, the wrong picture.
They like to do that, to really demean people.
That's right. But she didn't stop. She came out, she said, you know, these are lies, they're not my pictures. And then she kept going on. But she was harassed. You know, the people who were helping her were harassed. And they ended up arresting her, her mother, and her younger sister. Mm-hmm. You know, they put them in jail. And then later on, because her other sister, Anne, she's got an American citizenship, they released her. But they kept their mother, they kept her in, they kept Diane in jail, and her mom. Okay, and just to let people know, before even that happened, you know, the father, that family is one of the richest families in Rwanda, because you know, they have manufacturing plants and stuff like that. But what Kagame did, just to show them that they would never dare to you know, to oppose his words, he closed the one of my manufacturing plant. You know, they killed the father of the family. From what all the reports are saying right now, they
certainly the family is convinced of that. Absolutely.
But yeah, and even as we hear that some people confirm as was a plan by the RPF, and also now what they're doing, selling all their property. You know. Everything they have, they destroyed their hotel. Now they are saying, I believe it was today. Today they were selling also what's left of their belongings. Mm-hmm. I mean, and then we are asking, why then Canada, a country that is one of the top countries that stands for human rights, you know, can roll the red carpet for a criminal like Kagame?
Yes.
You know?
Well, you had a great sign. Somebody held up a sign asking this question. They said, why? No, not why, but end the impunity for Kagame. And he has impunity. He gets to do things, and nobody investigates.
That's right. And what we're trying to do, actually, as a Rwandan community, I can remind those who follow us that I was there representing the Rwandan community. You know, we have wrote letters. We have wrote letters to the Minister Goodell, who's in charge of security in Canada, through our lawyer, you know, asking to declare Kagame a personal non grata on the Canadian on the Canadian soil, but you know, we never got a response till now. We also sent out a communique from the our organization, okay, and you know, putting out the reasons why we have asked Kagame, our government, not to continue, you know.
Yes.
We can't understand how Canada, the seven leaders of the world, can sit around the table with a criminal like him. The guy has so much blood on his hand. And what I should also let know to the Canadians who are following us right now is that whatever they are being told about Rwanda being you know, an example of growth economy in Rwanda is wrong, because many experts say it, you know, that
it's,
Rwanda, they've
it's
been
called smoke and mirrors, right?
That's right.
David
that's
Himbara,
right.
By the way, David Himbara's Twitter, people should go there. He documents what Freddie Usabuera is pointing out. He is an economist. He traces all the lies and points to the facts.
That's right. Actually, some examples, just a few examples, if you can,
yes,
if
please.
I can just say, you know, Rwanda, people are dying of hunger. Over 150,000 for just the last 2 years have fled the country to the eastern other countries, the eastern countries in Rwanda, you know, and Rwanda has been receiving money to help. You know, Rwanda need food aid, you know, every year. And the WFP has been spending about $10.4 million a year, you know, to help with those problems. Okay. Mm-hmm. Rwanda is the 17th most poorest country on the world. Okay. Mm-hmm. And the other thing, just about the cooking the numbers, you saw the West can see that Rwanda is growing, you know, mm-hmm. They have published their tourist income as a 40,000 million, you know, last year, as they claim. Actually, they're claiming they have made 400, but the number they published was of 20 million only, you know, and, you know, and those keeps going on.
Yes.
What Kagame has done was with the money, actually with a tax, with the taxes we sent to him, you know, mm-hmm. he has built some buildings in Kigali.
He depends on foreign aid.
That's right. 40%, actually, 40% of the budget of Rwanda up to date is made of foreign money.
Yeah. Now, Freddie, I want to make sure I ask you this before, because I don't think listeners know, if you could tell us very quickly. There is a crisis with refugees in Western Rwanda, where they have the people that they used to claim they were liberating, the so-called Banyamulenge, but they are in camps. Is that true? And UNHCR is supposed to be protecting them? What's happening?
Yes. Yes, actually what happened, to make the story short, is that in 1990, when Rwanda started the war, you know, in some countries, you know, our neighboring countries, there are people who live there that speak our language, the Kinyarwanda. So after the Second World War, when the Africa, the Europeans, and you know, the Western countries started to, you know, so they have decided where the borders have to be in our countries, and some people, well, who were on the side of Rwanda, ended up being in Congo, Uganda, or Tanzania, or elsewhere. So when Kagame attacked, he went because there was Rwandophone big community in the Congo, you know, he convinced them that his war was also their war. Okay, they joined his forces, helped take power in Rwanda, but then after, so he was using them. After, he used them to go attack the country, the Congo, you know, mm-hmm. and then after the war, he has built some refugee camps for them. Keep them inside Rwanda, you know. The
inside Rwanda.
Yeah, that's right. The one he didn't know, he didn't want to be using again, you know, because mm-hmm. he was also planning again some wars to attack the Congo, as he did in 1996-97. He built the refugee camps. He kept them there. So in that case, he could get money from the Western, saying, you know what, I have refugees here to help.
Yeah, but those refugees want to go home, and he won't let them.
Yes, they said, they told him straight out. They go, you know what? You used us. We don't want you be used anymore. You are sending our kids to fight for your own interest. You know, you have been killing us for ages. Now we won't go back home, or we are asking the UNHCR just to be, you know, resettled in another country. We can't keep living under this condition.
Yeah.
So the Rwanda didn't want that. What the refugees did, then they decided to leave the camp, went to the office of the UN office, the NCCR office in the Eastern Province, where they live.
Yeah.
And then the next day, what the Rwandan Kagame decided to send his army, you know, they shoot on the refugee.
Shooting.
They killed people, actually.
Yes.
Yeah, they killed some of them, so they had to run out for their lives, went back in their camp, those who didn't end up dead.
So shooting his old allies.
That's right. And then, a few weeks after, he sent other troops, you know, the security troops of his army. Actually, what's being said is that probably most of them are part of the President Guard force. They went. You know, they encircled the camp, and they want to arrest the leaders of the refugees, because the leaders of the refugees were saying, you know what, you can't keep killing us like you know, like we don't have rights to leave.
And his answer is, yes, I can.
That's right. And then he went on again, yeah. killed them. And then you end up seeing him on the list of invited people in Canada. It's not unacceptable.
Absolutely.
And again, also, what I have forgot also to tell the people is that in 2010, actually, the UN experts did a tremendous job in investigating the killings and the human rights violations in the Congo when Rwanda attacked the Congo in 1996, 97, and 98. And the conclusion of the report is called the Mapping Report, Congo's yeah. mapping report that it was out in October 2010. And the conclusions are more than clear. The experts say that Kagame's troop, under his orders, have made, you know, crimes against humanity, war crimes, and also crimes of genocide.
Yes. And that report is going to be where we have to end. Freddy Usabuera, thank you very, very much. You covered all that ground in it, and you had a great demonstration. We're very glad to talk to you and look forward to talking to you again.
Okay, thank you very much, Phil. And before I go, I'll just remember people that not only I am the member of the community, I am a member of the community, the Rwandan community, but also the spokesman of our campaign for change in Rwanda, Amahoro Iwacu, which is spelled Riwacu. And people can follow us on our website, which is amahoriwacu.org, or also follow us on our Facebook, you know, and help us change the situation in Rwanda.
Thank you. We will post that ourselves, and we'll remind people of it in the future. Thank you, Freddie.
Thank you very much, Phil, and thanks for having me.
Sure thing. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
And thanks for coming, and thanks, Febby. I bet we better get out of here. We'll see you next week.